It's not another college fraternal society. Yale University is the only university in the United States, or indeed the world, which has senior societies. These are societies where 15 are selected in the junior year and actually are initiated at the beginning of the senior year. They stay on campus only 1 year as members. They are called Knights. When they graduate, they leave the university, they go out into the world, then they're known as Patriarchs. So at any one time, you only have 15 Knights in existence, and for the rest of their lives, they're known as Patriarchs. And they work during their lifetime, or a number do, towards the ends of the order. They are pretty much guaranteed success. Certainly they're guaranteed financial success. And in my reading of the material I have, I infer that so long as they go along with the purposes of the order, so long as they gear their careers and their lives towards certain ends, then they are guaranteed success.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. On Friday, no, it's not the 12th, it's the 26th of February, 2021. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. He's got his boiler suit off now and he's fixed the heating system from last week. In the second part tonight, Shamima Begum in the news again today. She can't come home to get justice. Oh dear, because of national security. Well, Martin and I know exactly what that means, and it's got nothing to do with justice. So the Supreme Court making political decisions once again to protect criminals in the security services. And Russophobia, how did it start and where is it heading? With Reuters and the BBC this week embroiled in a new scandal shown to be part of an anti-Russia propaganda program being paid to lie. This week, and Navalny falls from grace. Videos and documents circulating around the world showing Alexei Navalny, the darling of the Western press and the nemesis, supposedly, according to them, of Vladimir Putin, show him up for the racist that he is. Just a week after our very own Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees gave him an unprompted character reference. Whoopsie daisy. And Yale's Skull and Bone Society, the unavowed expert on it, Professor Tony Sutton, explains what Yale is recruiting young men for. And Yale's other recruit, a bit of an exclusive tonight, Chairman Mao. Back in 1919 and 1920, Yale recruited Mao to edit their newspaper, and he went on to become the chairman of the Chinese Communist Party. The new Cold War started with the Magnitsky Act under Obama, and we British quickly followed suit. But where is it heading? We'll be talking about that after 6 o'clock. And China's digital gulag in the Xinjiang province. We hear tonight not from the documentary makers, but from the Uyghurs themselves. The Uyghur Congress is international, and we speak to Rahima Mahmoud all about President Xi's ambitions on what life is actually really like in Xinjiang today, and why Beijing is targeting this part of the country particularly and turning it into a digital gulag. Plus, they're killing the high street and small and medium businesses whilst the transnational giants thrive. Are the Tory party killing them? Capitalism. Is that really what they're supposed to do, or that we're elected to do? An article from Lucy writes for Conservative Woman about that. And also, the new but instantly banned off BitChute French documentary that we covered a bit of last week, sadly without Martin, but I'm sure he'll be interested to comment this week. We got another clip from that banned documentary, Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers, subtitled JFK and 9/11, 50 Years of the Deep State, by the French journalist Laurent Guillenot. This show is repeated at 11 on Fridays, 11 p.m. and 11:05 p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. And over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioqUK.com. My three e-books published in the 3 weeks of the Halloween lockdown, Traitors of Arnhem, The Siege of Heaven and The Siege in Heaven Reader, You can get free watermark copies of these, and they're available at bilderberg.org to pay for if you'd like. But first, we do a follow-up on last week's look at the Queen's land holdings in Canada. We'll hear how the land was claimed for God, but what happens when the monarchy drops its connection to the Bible, as Prince Charles is doing? And what's going on with Prince Philip? His vaccine went well, didn't it? If they really had the Pfizer jab or AstraZeneca, is someone trying to bump off the royal family? The online harms bill also we'll be talking about now chugs along. It's shutting down free speech online under the guise of stopping hate bots. And also, you can't miss this one, salmon and sturgeon, the two fishes daggers drawn today. Is that anything to do with salmon's RTTV show by any chance that they don't like? And the budget is next week. Will Rishi Sunak be embracing some great reset ideas like everybody's being given a universal basic income? The council down in Froome just passed a motion, that's in Somerset, saying yes, please. And a bit of the about the vaccine passports and human rights abuses by the Syrian government in the news this week. I think that sounds like part two, actually. But nothing still about Bush and Blair. Anyway, Martin, I think maybe we'll start by looking at some of the shenanigans going on within the Labour Party here in the UK, particularly in Liverpool. There's been some sort of a debacle in Liverpool with the official candidates, a little bit like happened with Frank Dobson and Ken Livingstone in London a few years ago for London mayor. So the Labour Party endorsed a candidate for London mayor that actually the local party and the local members didn't really support.
Yeah, well, I have followed this a little bit. There was a women-only shortlist to replace the guy Joe, whose second name I've forgotten, who's been removed potentially for criminal behaviour. And, of course, they're now talking about replacing him with somebody from in the Labour ranks, but it's got to be a women-only shortlist. The head of that shortlist, I understand, was the current Lord Mayor of Liverpool, similar setup to what we've got here in Bristol, but she was basically regarded as unsuitable because being too much in the more Corbyn camp. And therefore, there's a big... my friend Dinah Jeter was at the university there, and she's saying there's actually quite a big discussion in Liverpool about whether they want a mayor at all, because they had a mayor, but it wasn't through a referendum. And they've got a similar sort of arguments to the arguments that are going on in Bristol. Do we want a mayor? And if we do want a mayor, who's it going to be?
Labour Hub say the selection race between the Labour's candidate for Liverpool mayor was sparked by sitting mayor Joe Anderson being arrested on suspicion of something naughty. So, you know, what you've got, it seems here, is either you've got politicians who are crooks and criminals, or else you've got the idea of, you know, basically character assassinations of people being used in order to get... it certainly doesn't look good for the Labour Party. Joe Anderson was arrested on suspicion of conspiracy to commit bribery and witness intimidation. Labour had started the process to select a new mayor candidate, and a panel shortlisted three local women for the race. All three took part in two hustings for city members. So far, so good. But suddenly, on the day ballots were expected to drop, the contest was suspended. The three candidates had to attend second interviews last Friday. I mean, it sounds to me the Labour Party is drowning in a sea of bureaucracy.
Well, what's happening is that the Starmer regime, if we can call it that, is determined to control what the Labour Party is and what it does. And so, you know, there's definitely the full-time officials. They were the people that were basically sabotaging Jeremy Corbyn's rule of the Labour Party, as it were. They are very, you know, very much back in control and very much trying to make sure that they control who gets selected for various seats and so on and so forth. You know, pretty much back to business as usual before the Corbyn era. And of course, quite a lot of people have resigned as a result of all of this. And that's not necessarily a problem for the new regime, because everybody that resigns means that they don't have to take any notice of those people anymore. So it's a pretty serious infight situation.
Well, this is perfect for the Tories, isn't it?
It is, and of course, I voted for Starmer on the understanding that he would try and, you know, basically govern from the centre of the Labour Party. But for whatever reason, I'm not really surprised that he's gone down this essentially Blairite route, and including the control freakery. But I think the problem that he's going to find as he goes down that route is that makes the internal fighting in the Labour Party the issue. And he may be able to spin that to his advantage, because all the left-wing people complaining about what he's doing, whether it's to do with the, you know, ridiculous anti-Semitism allegations, etc., it means that he can then position himself in the minds of the wider public as somebody who's a scourge of the left wing of the Labour Party. Well, look, you think it's a poor strategy myself. Party. But you could see why he might think that might be okay for him if he's trying to position himself, you know, basically wrap himself in the Union Jack, which we've been told he intends to do.
We've had something similar going on here in Bristol, actually, at Bristol West. So I keep hearing and reading little bits and pieces about where there was about to be an election of some sort, an AGM.
Yes, I attended it.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden that's scrapped. And then when there's another one, the first thing that happens is everybody's saying, well, you haven't actually followed any of the proper procedures in this new AGM, so it's not valid. So, you know, it just sounds to me like...
Yeah, well, they've told us now that it was valid. I participated in it, and basically... It was run by the full-time officials at regional office who took over the running of it. And, you know, they basically, there was basically an election for the officers for the coming year. And every single position, there were basically two candidates, one from the left of the party, one from the new regime candidates. And, it went on for over 4 hours. I mean, I logged on at 6:20 for a 7 p.m. start for the meeting, and I didn't get to vote till 10 o'clock. And apparently some people didn't get to vote till midnight. And that's because they were making sure that only people couldn't get to vote if they were regarded as in some way having not fulfilled. You know, they were looking to weed people out, basically. A lot of people aren't not very happy about it. I complained to regional office, but I got an email back saying, as far as they're concerned, it's a legitimate meeting, and the decisions are made. So, I mean, the Labour Party is going to have, there's going to be lots of legal challenges to people who've been accused of anti-Semitism and so on, and they're going to take that to court. We're already at the point we'll see you in court on a lot of that. And I'm afraid that Starmer's made the decision that that's how he wants to go. And, of course, that means that this row will go on and on and on, because just going to walk away.
That's right. The guy is a lawyer, isn't he? So, I mean, I suppose he's saying, well, actually, it doesn't matter if I'm just breaking procedures or whatever. If I take this all to court, I might win. And anyway,
no, he won't win. I think that's the mistake he's making. It's astonishing that somebody who is so trained in the law as he is, I mean, the settlement that he made with the people that sued the Labour Party, who were the full-time officials that had sabotaged the Corbyn leadership, and then they sued the party because they said that they'd been defamed, etc., that was settled out of court, and they were given quite a lot of money. And John Ware from Power On was also involved in this. But the legal advice the party had, that if they went to court, they would lose. Now, as somebody who's paid my subs to the Labour Party since 1975, I resent paying those people off. And they got quite a lot of money as well. We're not talking trivial damages. And that is actually the money that's been built up over many years by loyal members like me paying their subs. And it's been handed to people who would have lost in court. Now, what's also going to happen is the people from the other side are now going to take the party to court, and they will win, because the international definition of Holocaust denial or whatever it is basically legally full of holes, and that it can't be used as a disciplinary text. And therefore, those who have been disciplined using it will win in court, and they will win damages. And of course, it could be that since substantial damages were awarded to the right-wing rebels, as it were, substantial damages could be rewarded to the left-wing rebels to such an extent that the Labour Party may not have enough money to fight future elections. because it all comes down to money at the end of the day. Now, all of this is terribly disappointing to some extent, but hardly to be avoided, because, as I've said many times on this show, the first past the post system means they are stuck with us and we are stuck with them. There isn't any alternative. They can't get rid of us, but Martin,
that's no excuse for these sort of underhand, dirty tricks, backstabbing tactics. I mean, if you consider that it's a broad church. Also, in the left in Bristol this week, we've had a Bristol University professor who's been on this programme a few times, making what are, in quotes, appalling comments in a Zoom call. Both the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees and Bristol West MP Thangam Debonair have spoken out against Professor David Miller's comments. Now, he's a professor of sociology at Bristol University and a very much sort of left-leaning one. The Bristol Post quotes some of his comments. He said, apparently, he said, Professor David Miller called for the end of Zionism. And he said, Israel is trying to exert its will all over the world. In a Zoom call last Saturday. Well, he may or may not have done. That's at least what's being alleged here. And I did actually speak to David Miller this week, but he's not allowed to say anything for a couple of weeks at all because he's going through some sort of procedure up at the university. And so, you know, which means basically he can't defend himself publicly, although all these people are out in public in full strength, assassinating his character. He's not allowed to say a word. The sociology lecturer apparently later said Jewish students were being used as political pawns by a violent, racist foreign regime and accused his university's Jewish society, Bristol JSOC, of a campaign of censorship, making some students unsafe. So Bristol West Labour MP Thangam Debonair described the conduct as completely unacceptable. She said, I'm following this appalling behaviour by a Bristol University lecturer up with the university. She wants him sacked, Martin.
Yes, that's very clear. And of course, Marvin has also come out against David Miller. David Miller is no longer a member of the Labour Party, so he can't be disciplined by the Labour Party. It's a question of whether he's going to lose his job at the university, even though he is a sociology lecturer and a bit of an expert on international affairs, unlike Thangam and Marvin, who are local politicians.
Professor Miller claimed that Keir Starmer had taken Zionist money.
Yes, he took money from for his campaign to be elected as leader of the Labour Party. I've forgotten the name, Trevor Chin, I think it is, who's a very prominent pro-Zionist businessman. This is what happened during the Blair era, where gradually Blair was trying to wean the Labour Party off trade union funding and membership funding and basically getting large donations from big businesses like Sainsbury's. And, of course, this is a mechanism in order to control policy in the Labour Party. And we've now got a situation where a panel which will deal with anti-Semitism allegations has been appointed, which includes Joan Ryan, who left the Labour Party when she was found out colluding with Shai Mossad, the Mossad agents from the Israeli embassy, to fix things inside the Labour Party. She is now back in the Labour Party and on the panel that will decide who and what is anti-Semitic. So the only positive thing I can see about this, it's very negative developments, but the only positive thing I can see about this from the Palestine Solidarity point of view is that the issue of Israel and its racist occupation and land grabbing is going to be central to British politics. Central. Everybody's going to be talking about it. And I'm afraid most people have got other things to think about, whether it's COVID or Brexit or whatever. But by doing this, the Israeli embassy and their allies have made Israel the major issue in British politics, including their unilateral grabbing of land in the Golan Heights. And it brings into question for my mind all of the land that they've taken since 1948, never mind 1967, and the legitimacy of the state as whole. Maybe they shouldn't have a seat at the United Nations.
OK, so...
Lots of countries
I think it's just important for our listeners to hear what David Miller said, and they can make up their own mind about whether they think that he should be removed from his job as a professor of sociology at Bristol University, like, you know, many members of the
so-called... Can I just make another point, Tony?
Yeah, go on.
I've also got Gavin Williamson, the head of the education secretary, appointing a so-called free speech czar. Why would you want a czar for free speech, you know, to go around creating, you know, it's a rather odd term to use, isn't it? But I mean, this is a clear example of somebody who is having their freedom of speech and their right to be in the university at all questioned. And if this free speech means anything, then whether you agree with him or not, David Miller should not be removed from the university.
Well, he's got
and of course,
tenure,
the university have made no statement at all about it, because they know very well if they try and remove him, it will end up in court and they quite likely will lose.
So, the individual you mentioned that Starmer has employed is a former Israeli intelligence agent. During an online campaign for free speech event last Saturday, David Miller said, "This is an all-out onslaught by the Israeli government on the left globally," he said. "It's not just something that's happened in Britain. It's also happened in France and Germany before it got to the UK and also in the US. The Labour Party," says David Miller, "is a mere detail in this attempt by Israelis to impose their will all over the world. It's not enough to say Zionism is racism. Israel is a settler colonial society."
Well, the UN passed a resolution in the General Assembly in the 1970s saying that Zionism was racism, and that was a majority of the world's governments who agreed with that. And I'm afraid that there used to be a left Zionism. That is to say that they were in favour of the state of Israel, but they were against the more extreme land-grabbing tendencies of the right wing in Israel. That hardly exists anymore. B'Tselem, which is one of the biggest Israeli human rights groups, has come out quite straightforwardly and said modern Israeli state is an apartheid state. It's a racist state, with the implication that sanctions, similar to the sanctions that were put on South Africa, should be put on the state of Israel.
Can I just put my position, Martin, and then I'll ask you to put yours? I mean, I'm not an anti-Zionist per se. I just believe that if the Jews are going to return to Israel, they need to stick to the Balfour Declaration. All of those promises that were given, both at the beginning of the Israeli state at the UN, and also during the First World War in the Balfour Declaration, have to be taken seriously. I haven't got a problem with any Jew that goes to live in Jerusalem, so long as they do not then implant themselves in some kind of racist battle in order to strangle Palestinians and, in fact, possibly even kill Palestinians by stopping them having medical care.
Well, the Balfour Declaration was illegitimate, basically. I mean, the British had no right giving Palestine away to anybody. It didn't even belong to them to give away. So that's the first point.
Well, we were occupying it, Martin.
Yes, and therefore the Palestinians got no say. And therefore, there's a question about whether Britain had the right to make the Balfour Declaration. It's quite possible, you could argue with hindsight, that they have no right to make such a declaration. The second point is that Israel was recognised by the United Nations in 1948, with the caveat that they would be within a very limited area. They were given a ceasefire line to stay behind because they've been fighting and so on. And that was going to be their state. And it was recognised by the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, as well as by the Americans. The British actually weren't very happy about it, but when the Americans said that they were going to recognise it, Truman was under a lot of pressure from Zionist lobbyists in the US, then the State of Israel was established. It immediately expanded beyond the borders of what it had been given, and then expanded again in 1967. Now, I would argue, even according to the letter of the law, Israel is only recognised as a state if it stays within the boundaries that were agreed when it was established in 1948. Now, of course, everything up since then has been the Palestinians have accepted the boundaries of 1967 as being legitimate, but no further. I would go further and say this: if Israel does not accept the boundaries that it was given in 1948, then it should not be recognised as an independent state. It should lose its seat in the United Nations. Plenty of countries would like to be in the United Nations. Kashmir, Kosovo. There's all sorts of countries that would like to be recognised, but they're not. Kurdistan. Okay. And the same goes for Israel. If you're not going to play by the rules, then you can't be in the club. Okay. And ultimately, of course, there can be sanctions on you. And if don't forget, Israel is essentially a US welfare state. Without massive amounts of US taxpayers' money, they would not be able to have the lifestyle they have. And I also disagree that people should be able to go from anywhere in the world to live in Israel just because they are Jewish.
Martin, so you think if a Jewish person in Bristol wants to go to Israel, they should be stopped?
I think that the Palestinians, who are the indigenous population, should be able to have their own immigration policy, just like we have our own immigration policy. Priti Patel was allowed in, her family from Uganda or Kenya in the 1970s.
She was allowed into Israel, too.
That was a decision by the British government. And it wasn't a decision by somebody else.
She was not only allowed into Israel, she was very much welcomed in Israel.
Priti Patel, of course, you know, there's a question about whether she should be a British citizen. Enoch Powell would have said she shouldn't be. And she, of course, panders to those people who think like Enoch Powell.
Okay,
I find it rather extraordinary, really.
Since we can't...
fact, the argument could be that she should be living in Uganda or Kenya. And if she didn't want to live there, she could go back and live in India, where her family came from originally. Where, of course, she's a very strong supporter of Modi and his Hindutva nationalism in India.
Okay.
So there we go.
I mean, I'm a great supporter of David Miller. I think he's one of the best, greatest sociologists actually on the planet. And particularly because I suppose he's so articulate, certain people, just a bit like us on our program, if I'm allowed to say that, you know, people just want to shut us up. They want to stick a sock in our mouth.
I must admit, I'm surprised that both Marvin Rees and Thangam Debonair have seen fit to nail their colours to this particular mast. If I was them, I would have stayed out of it.
No, but
David Miller is in fact an expert on these matters.
Martin, these people are basically part of a clique. They're tribal. They don't have principles. They just do what their so-called betters tell them to do. Anyway, because David Miller can't chat to us today, I thought, and one of the first times I came across David was when he founded something called Spinwatch, which I, as a freelance journalist, was very, very interested in, because it gave details, and it still does online, gives details of the real financial interests of a lot of these so-called independent experts that we see on television, people like Patrick Vallance, who's on the government's chief scientific advisor, medical advisor, financial interests, his long-term, you know, share interests, his jobs in big business, the rotating door syndrome, you know, revolving door syndrome. David Miller's site on Spinwatch has been absolutely brilliant on that, and you can see quite often, if you see somebody on the television that looks a bit suspicious, quickly look them up on your phone on Spinwatch, and you'll see, oh, look, the BBC have said they're independent. They're not at all. So let's have a listen now anyway to David Miller speaking last week about Julian Assange. And we may hear a short one later, but let's hear now a little bit about who is this guy that our local MP, Thangam Debonair, and our mayor, Bristol mayor, so-called Labour people, Marvin Rees, think is so terrible and should be sacked from his job.
The Assange case is, of course, a landmark case and will be remembered for many years to come. And people have been talking about secrecy and state security and the difficulty of getting news out about such matters. And I wanted to sort of start by reminding us all that of David Lee's famous little statement that he had in his book, The Frontiers of Secrecy, from 1980. I think maybe John and Tim are the only ones who are old enough to remember that book, but I do as well. Which is that the obverse of the secrecy coin is always propaganda. And of course, the reason that they wanted to get Assange, part of the reason was that they didn't want the footage of the American helicopter gunship opening up on Iraqi civilians, including actually journalists in the streets. And they didn't want that information to go out to the public so that we would know even more about the horrific crimes caused by the invasion of Iraq on, as we'll also remember, on a false prospectus, on the basis of a propaganda campaign to convince us that there was an actual threat from the Saddam Hussein regime. So the secrecy is not just something which civil servants have a reflex for, which of course they do in this country, but it's also something which is there to guard their information so that we can't know how our society operates. And we can't know, especially in relation to issues of national security, foreign policy and defence, we can't know what it is that the government gets up to in our name, except in carefully controlled slices of hopefully anodyne news coverage, which is what they largely get on the mainstream news every night. So secrecy is intimately bound up with propaganda. The peculiar British disease of secrecy is such that it's not just that there are things which are secret, but there are also things which the government says are not secret, but which they would really rather you didn't report, if that's okay, old chap. And they do that through an informal committee called, as everyone will know, you probably don't know, through the committee which is now called the DSMA Committee, for probably better known as under its old name, and that's probably why they've changed the name, in the way that they changed the name of Winsfield to Sellafield, the D-Notice Committee. And now this is a committee, extraordinarily enough, which is made up largely, there are some civil servants there from effectively representing the intelligence agencies, but largely made up of journalists who regularly trot along to these committee meetings, and the minutes are published these days, and they listen to civil servants and the spooks tell them what it would be really nice if they didn't report. And quite a lot of the time, it seems they don't report this. And it's not because it's against the law for them to report it. It's just because the government says it would really be rather nice if we didn't do it, and they just do it. And that's the extraordinary kind of position we're in with secrecy in this country. And recently, well, how recently was it? I just pulled up my machine here. Oh, 2018. So in 2018, we got hold of two D-notices issued by the D-notice committee. Now, these are documents which the D-notice committee has previously said don't exist. There's no such thing as a D-notice that's slapped on the media. Well, as it turns out, they do exist. We published them in 2018, the ones on the Skripal affair, diverting attention from the connections between Sergei Skripal and his MI6 handler, who lived very close by to him in Salisbury. And I don't want to go into the Skripal case, but this is an indication of the deeply sinister way in which voluntary agreements between government and the media curtail the public's right to know the misconduct, let's put it in a polite way, of state actors. Now, the most recent bill that's just gone through the Commons, which were disgracefully one of Starmer's many disgraces, the Labour Party didn't vote against it, will make that, institutionalise that much, much further. It will make it legal for the spooks to commit crimes. And of course, they won't be crimes anymore because the spooks have committed them. And so we're living in a society where increasingly, and this has been, I suppose this has been the case for a while, but increasingly the state does not care what we can know. It doesn't want us to know anything at all. It wants to be able to commit crimes by intelligence agents, and it wants to be able to close down all information that there is on how the powerful actually operate. And this is a fairly big crisis, I think, of public communication, where censorship and secrecy are the rule of the day, even in the, you know, even in the supposedly massively open age of the internet. And of course, that's what the spooks have been responding to in the Assange case, in WikiLeaks case, the possibility of mass transmission of digital information, which they hadn't really anticipated could be done in the way in which it was done for the purposes of journalism and exposing power holders. And so we live in a period where there's a huge attempt to clamp down on the possibilities of us knowing anything about what the secret state is up to, but also where we see the tech companies engaged very closely with the state and with various Western states, trying to censor, especially anti-establishment political commentary. We've seen various political parties have their social media accounts suspended recently, and a whole range of independent and critical and radical journalists who are uniformly, you know, slandered as being racists or anti-Semites or whatever is the term de jure to slander the left in order to get them removed from social media. So that there's a kind of context to this, which is that there's the overweening secrecy of the state, but there's also a massive attempt to curtail the possibility of free communication, which is a genuine threat to the people in power. So I just want to end there and say that, you know, the importance of the Assange case is that he represents, and WikiLeaks represents, a genuine threat to Western elite power. That's, you know, it's the first and most important reason why we should support the case of Julian Assange and try and make it possible for as many people as possible to get access to information which they can use to properly evaluate the people who they're called upon to vote every 5 years. And just one thing to close on, one little bit of information. I mean, in the last 2 and a bit years, the Anonymous Collective have been leaking government documents, first from a government-funded Foreign Office MI6-funded project called the Integrity Initiative, and then latterly, at the end of last year, and just more documents released, the fourth tranche of documents released only last week, documents from the Foreign Office on its funding of subversive activities in Syria, in Lebanon, and indeed in Russia. Now, these are tremendous service to public information, but they don't get very much traction in the mainstream media, and some, you know, probably not enough traction in the independent media either. And I think for the left going forward, this is one area where there's a real need to put resources into proper investigations of such materials, because the mainstream media will not do it, and otherwise this stuff will not get the kind of traction it really deserves. And I mean, there should be public inquiries about each of these leaks from Anonymous, but so far we've had really virtually nothing apart from one complaint which we helped to make to the Office of the Scottish Charity Regulator about the Institute for Statecraft, which ran the Integrity Initiative program, which got it closed down, to be fair. So there's a huge scope for people on the left and in the independent media to be doing much more proper digging.
Well, proper digging is what we do. He's really there, Martin. Obviously, he's focusing on Assange, but he's really talking about massive amounts of secrecy going on. And when somebody says something that is not liked by an elite behind the scenes, they're shut down. Now, whether that be censored or sacked, the reaction, and this I can remember discussing with BBC colleagues years ago, Peter Mandelson on the right of the Labour Party used to love phoning up when he heard some coverage that he didn't like. He'd phone up an editor or he'd phone up the journalist directly and say, if you say that again, I'm going to get you sacked. Now, this isn't really, well, it's certainly not cricket, but it's certainly not the way to a democracy can function. A democracy will die if it carries on like this.
I think that's right. But I think the only thing I can say about this is that the attacks on people and attempts to remove them and silence them, that is also a sign of weakness by the powers that be. And we need to pick them up on it. And there's no, I mean, look at the government is openly trying to pass laws, which the Labour Party has in Parliament has generally they abstained on them, which are basically calling for the military and the intelligence services and the police to be above the law. I mean, it's as blatant as that. Why would you want to claim that? I mean, what's been happening up to now is that they claim that they're working under the rule of law, but we all know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, certain things go on. But basically, they are accountable, and they're accountable under the law. They are now passing a law which says that we don't have to obey the law. You couldn't get a clearer indication. And of course, we could end up going to war with Iran, and then suddenly everybody that criticizes that will be closed down. And we're moving into a totalitarian future as long as we allow this kind of thing to happen. And therefore, we must speak up about it, and we must make a fuss.
Yeah, we certainly must. So anyway, let's have a listen now to some of the big announcements we've had this week with the roadmap out of lockdown, supposedly. Boris Johnson announced on Monday this week, the 22nd of February. So the roadmap out of the English lockdown, of course, all these countries are now run separately. We've got this weird phrase saying the is it the Four Nations or something? Northern Ireland, England, Wales, and Scotland. It's almost as if we've already been divided up into regions, you know, by Brussels. But apparently, you know, Brexit has made no difference to that. Maybe things are just going on as they would have done without Brexit. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Boris talking about the roadmap out of the English lockdown this week.
Whenever we ease the lockdown, whether it's today or in 6 or 9 months, we've got to be realistic and accept that there will be more infections, more hospitalizations, and therefore, sadly, more deaths, just as there are every year with flu. Even if we sustain the lockdown indefinitely, which would itself cost lives and do immeasurable harm to our children, we would not be able to eradicate this disease. And that's why it's right gradually to replace the protection afforded by the lockdown with the protection of the vaccines. And our approach is to move with the utmost care and advancing in 4 steps, each with a minimum of 5 weeks apart, so we can properly judge the impact of each relaxation before we move on. And you can see the details of all of this on gov.uk. And we will be led at every stage by data, not dates, and we will apply 4 tests. The pace of the vaccination programme, the effectiveness of the vaccines, the pressure on the NHS, and the risks of any new variants of COVID. And therefore, as we look at the data today, I can confirm that 2 weeks from today, Monday the 8th of March, we will begin step one. And schools and colleges across England will reopen, and teaching in classrooms can start again. All the evidence shows that schools are safe and the risk posed to children by COVID is vanishingly small. But to offer even greater reassurance, we're introducing twice weekly testing of secondary school and college pupils and asking them to wear face coverings for the rest of this term. Students on practical courses can return to university, but all others will need to continue learning online and will review the situation before the end of the Easter holidays. We will allow breakfast and after-school clubs to restart, and among other changes, on March the 8th, you'll be able to have a coffee on a bench or a picnic in a park with one person outside your household. And because we know how stressful this time has been and how people yearn to see friends and family, if only fleetingly, we will now go further. And on the 29th of March, you can meet more of your friends and family outside, including in gardens, either as 2 households or subject to the rule of 6. And then we'll go on to step 2, which is no earlier than the 12th of April. And this is a big moment because shops will return and reopen, hairdressers, nail salons will reopen, pubs and restaurants will all be able to serve customers outside, precisely because we know that outside the risk of transmission is lower. And then 5 weeks after that, no earlier than May the 17th, we'll go to step 3 and open all our hospitality sector to service indoors, pubs, bars, restaurants, along with hotels and cinemas. And subject to capacity limits, we will also open sports stadia, concert halls and theatres. And finally, provided we continue to pass the 4 tests, then from the 21st of June, we will go to step 4 and say goodbye to most remaining restrictions. Resuming large-scale events like business conferences and football matches, lifting the limits on weddings and reopening nightclubs. All of these steps will apply in England, and the government will continue to do whatever it takes to protect jobs and livelihoods across our whole United Kingdom for the duration of the pandemic. And I know there are some who would like to accelerate the timetable. And I know, of course, there are others who would like to be more cautious and stay in the slow lane. And I understand both points of view, and I sympathize, because levels of infection are still high, and we must strike a very careful balance and always accept that we've got to be humble in the face of nature. But also, we must accept that we cannot persist indefinitely, with restrictions that have separated families and loved ones for too long, threatened the livelihoods of millions, kept pupils out of school. It's thanks to the rollout of these vaccinations, many of them pioneered in this country, that the balance of that judgment is now changing in our favour. And thanks to the vaccinations, that there is light ahead, leading us to a spring and a summer, which I think will be seasons of hope, looking and feeling incomparably better for us all, and from which we will not go back.
Did you hear that? We will not go back. But what he says there actually is quite a lot of no earlier than blah blah blah. And then of course a few days later he's sort of backtracking. So Martin, you got another 4 months of this. Happy?
Well, no, not really. Obviously, not most, like most people, I'm not very happy with anything about this situation. I think he's facing both ways there. It's going to be data, not dates. And then he's given people a load of dates. And of course, what will happen then is if we are not really, you know, if we're getting close to the dates he's given, and then they're going to have to say, well, actually, we're going to have to put the date back. They'll then be under political pressure to go with the date that they've already given, because otherwise they'll look as if they've given the wrong date. And he's kind of given himself a bit of a let out on that. These dates are not fixed fixed. But just of course, if people have started booking weddings and so on, the pressure on him to go with the date rather than the data will be strong.
He doesn't seem to care about that. He hasn't bothered about that in the past. But people can book anything, and it just carries on. So back in November, December. It was the new variant suddenly popped up in order to keep the lockdowns going. What do you think they'll use next time to keep it going?
I don't think the new variant was used to the new variant popped up. And of course, what's happened previously, Tony, is that they've basically locked down too late and they've released three times already.
Let's just be clear about this.
They're going to do exactly the same thing again.
Let's just be clear about this. They said the new variant may be or even more deadly. But actually, as it proved, it wasn't either. So there's all sorts of guesswork, and we keep seeing, I saw on Peston, is someone I particularly detest, him putting Neil Ferguson on there, giving us his prognosis Wednesday night on Peston. All these people who've been discredited by their massive estimation of all the casualties. So what we've seen really is, I mean, I noticed, by the way, Dolores Cahill in Ireland saying that by her estimation, and she's doing her own survey at the moment to prove it, and maybe if we don't hear anything from her, she won't have proved it, to see whether the big spike that we had at the end of the year, November, December last year and January this year, was actually just influenza testing positive on the PCR tests. So we shall see. But I know you kind of want to keep us locked down forever and all be on some sort of dole, don't you, Martin?
No, I'm just pointing out that the government has basically got it wrong on the lockdowns three times. And I'm not very much convinced that they're going to get it right this time either. And of course, the problem for Boris is that if we do have to have a fourth lockdown, that will be him dead politically. And of course, it's quite possible. And do you know what I think is going to happen? They're going to release too soon. There's going to be a fourth lockdown. And the economy, of course, takes more and more of a hit every time you get it wrong, which, of course, in other parts of the world where they got it right, their economies are already.
This is exactly what the oligarchy want, isn't it? They want your economy,
Tony,
to take a hit. Yes, it is, because they want you in debt. And when you're in debt, you have to do what they tell you.
The banking system collapsed in September 2019.
No, it's still going.
The overnight,
Martin, it's still going. The banking system it may be bankrupt, but it's still being propped up.
It is being propped up. And of course, what's happened today, if you look at the markets, is that the bond market has started to react because they're starting to fear that the inflation will come back and they'll have to raise interest rates. Now, if any raising of interest rates at all will crash the financial markets. And of course, that is what's going to happen at some point. And that's what we really should be talking about. Not about COVID and not about Brexit, financial markets. But we haven't, because the COVID crisis overlaid the financial crisis. on the financial crisis will be there anyway. Most people think that the only reason they're bailing the banks out is because of COVID. That's not the case.
What we're now talking about, apparently, is these vaccine passports. We've been talking about these right from day one a year ago, but it seems like the legislators have sort of slowly caught up. But, I mean, I think this is really what this whole exercise is about. It's about saying that you won't be able to do this, that and everything else, go to the pub, etc., unless you've got an ID card and the government can switch it on and off at any point they wish. But we're going to have a listen now to the boss of the CRG, the COVID Research Group. Sounds suspiciously like the ERG.
Well, they're the COVID Recovery Group now, aren't they?
Recovery, yeah.
They've changed the name.
Well, it's interesting how all this
didn't
has
do
been
much
lining
research
up.
On Brexit either.
All been lining up with the Remain Brexit for some strange reason. It all seems to have tallied exactly with people's medical views. But anyway, Mark Harper is the Tory MP for Forest of Dean, and he chairs this COVID Recovery Group. And here he is speaking yesterday on the West Country Debate. And after him, you'll hear from Kerry McCarthy, the Bristol East Labour MP, talking about what she thinks about the same thing, which is basically what their reaction is to Boris's announcement this week.
Is we're starting the unlocking process on March the 8th, which is what we call for, and we're getting all children back to school on March the 8th, which I think is really important. Everyone agrees that that's really damaging.
The economy's not opening then.
No, and the bit I'm disappointed about is our argument had been, once you've vaccinated the top 9 groups, which the government's now, because the vaccination rollout's going so well, that's going to be done by the middle of April. Once they've been vaccinated, they account for 99% of the people that have tragically died from COVID and over 80% of hospitalisation. So that takes the pressure off of the National Health Service. And our argument was once you've vaccinated them, that's the point at which you'd be able to get rid of restrictions.
The Prime Minister saying he has no intention of bringing this forward. If anything, things may be delayed. But Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, had a bit of a pop at you, saying the Prime Minister shouldn't be listening to you. In fact, he's had a pop quite a few times this week.
If this roadmap is to work, he needs to listen to the Chief Scientific Officer and the Chief Medical Officer, not the Honourable Members for Wickham or the Forest of Dean.
What would you say to the Labour leader?
Well, what he was specifically referring to was some questions I asked about some of the modelling that underpins the assumptions. They may have been accurate when they were made, but they seem unduly pessimistic. I was simply asking some, what I thought, quite reasonable questions, but for some reason the Labour leader thought that was an extraordinary thing to do. Perhaps if he were better at it, Labour wouldn't be doing so dreadfully in the polls.
Should the Prime Minister be scared of this group in the way Theresa May was of the similarly named ERG during all the Brexit negotiations?
No, I don't think so. Look, my objective is to get the government to make the best possible decisions. We get out of this lockdown as soon as we safely can. I think we can do that a little bit faster. And we get the economy going again, and we can take advantage of the fantastic vaccine rollout so we can get people back to work, economies working, get our people's lives back on track again. And I want the government to be more successful. I think it can be. And as I said, a bit of challenge, some questions, I think is how you get you improve the government. It's not something the Prime Minister should be scared of. It's something he should welcome.
All right, Mark, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Kerry McCarthy, this vaccine rollout is going well in the southwest. Around 40% of adults have already had their first dose. You have spoken a lot about the issues for the music industry, in particular the gigs, very popular in Bristol. Would you support vaccine passports, effectively a certificate or online, to show maybe this summer people could go into a gig, scrap social distancing in that gig if they've been vaccinated?
I think, and this is something that some people have expressed real concern about, because they feel that it could be used against them if they, there are some people that are reluctant to have the vaccine, and I'd obviously encourage everyone to go ahead and get vaccinated. I think perhaps there's scope for it, but I'd rather sort of see us return to a sort of sense of normality where these events are sort of made as COVID secure as possible and everyone can participate in them. I think it's going to be some time, but, perhaps in terms of the outdoor events over this summer, we know that Glastonbury is not happening, but perhaps later in the summer, people will at least be able to congregate outside, and inside there may still have to be quite an element of social distancing.
So that's Bristol East MP for Labour, Kerry McCarthy there. She doesn't sound like she's into these vaccine passports. Are you going to get vaccinated, Martin?
Well, I'm waiting. I'm 61 years old. I've got underlying blood pressure condition, and I'm supposedly possibly going back to work next week or the week after in schools. So I would probably like to be vaccinated. I'm waiting to be told, basically.
And you're looking forward to it?
Not really, but I can't see there's any much of an option. I mean, from somebody like me, I could easily catch it in school. I mean, not in a normal year, when I'd be working in primary school, you'd expect to get flu and colds at least twice. So it's the sort of thing where it's quite likely to happen. And therefore, I'd probably like to be vaccinated because of my, you know, underlying blood pressure condition, and I'm 61. So, yeah, I'd want to be vaccinated. I'm not that keen on having the Pfizer vaccination. Because that's not really a vaccination, it's something else. But I can't see much of an option other than to do it.
Well, yeah, you can decide surely which vaccine you have.
No, you can't actually. Apparently, I know people who have gone in and they've said that they don't want the Pfizer vaccine, and they've been bullied to take the Pfizer vaccine, and they've gone away, and eventually they managed to get the
I know you're not going to cave in like that, Martin. Yes, you can, actually. You can say, I want the specific type of vaccine.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would like is the AstraZeneca vaccine, yeah. I don't particularly want... And, of course, the Pfizer vaccine is cost the government a hell of a lot more. It's 10 times the price, the same as the Moderna vaccine. And, of course, Moderna are making a huge killing at this, whereas, you know, the AstraZeneca are not doing too well financially out of it. But nevertheless, it's a cheaper option.
Well, talking to people who had the vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, supposedly, I mean, I was fairly cynical at the time as to whether the Duke of Edinburgh and the Queen had really had this, because from a medical point of view, certainly the doctors I've been talking to were saying that there were it was fraught with all sorts of dangers, and that actually having something like ivermectin or chloroquine handy in case the symptoms started were actually a much safer and more effective way of dealing with COVID. But the Duke of Edinburgh, I'm just looking at how he's getting on. He went into hospital last weekend. He's to spend his second weekend in hospital with an infection. They say it's nothing to do with his vaccine. So this, I'm afraid, is the way the royal family operates. As the rumours start to circulate about this maybe being vaccine related, that he's in hospital, so the palace issues an official denial. And as you and I know, you don't believe anything until it's been officially denied. What do you make of it's his longest ever stay in hospital, Martin?
Well, he's an old guy. I mean, you know, he's not long for this world, whichever way you look at it, is he? I've no idea what's going on with it.
And do you think it matters that the royal family? I mean, I think you tend to think that they're sort of symbolic, and they kind of
no, I don't think they're symbolic. They're obviously part of the undemocratic constitution of the country, which needs to be changed. But that's, you know, the actual medical condition of somebody as old as that. I mean, you know, he's getting on. There's no doubt about it. He's not going to be here that much longer. One way or another, he's going to be going.
So tomorrow, yeah, like the rest of us. So tomorrow it will become his longest ever stay as an inpatient. It's the longest he's spent in hospital since he had an operation in June 2013. Well, we wish him well, you know. I know he did say he wanted to come back as a deadly virus, didn't he, Martin?
He did, yes. He's a bit of a eugenicist, isn't he?
Yeah, a little bit like Boris Johnson's father. This is all a little bit worrying. Let's just mention this eugenicist business briefly, because when you've got Bill Gates's family and Boris's family quite close to this is quite frightening, really.
Well, these views that, you know, there were too many poor people, and you know, we'd do better off to be getting rid of them. I mean, some Tory councillor saying about free school meals that if you can't feed, don't breed, and that attitude is very much ingrained in the wealthy classes in this country. It got discredited after World War II because of the Nazi connection, but in actual fact, the underlying attitude that there are too many poor people is pretty much alive and well.
Well, it's been around for a long, long time. I can remember reading about the 17th century enclosures and 18th century enclosures, this was exactly what the people were saying then. Look, there's too many people here. We need to get them off the land. And so then they privatized the land and got rid of the people. And many of them just died in ditches and this sort of thing because they didn't have any homes anymore. And I think there is this sort of an attitude, which is one of the things that makes me more and more concerned about our politics here in Bristol, particularly with the mayor, Marvin Rees, refusing to be interviewed. I mean, basically, I'm going to have to do a Roger Cook job on him and doorstep him in order to get him to answer any of the questions that I put. I just don't think he wants to answer any of the questions. But it's not just the Labour mayor, Marvin Rees. Now, it's also the Green candidate for mayor, and our May election's just coming up. And his name's Sandy Hall-Ruthven. He's also refusing to be interviewed. He, like Marvin, refuses to give any reasons. He begins by saying, oh, I'm busy. And then when I start to interrogate him a little bit more and ask, you know, when can you do it? What we get is, not for a while. And then you have to keep asking questions and keep demanding replies until finally, after about 10 exchanges, and this exact same thing happened with the Metro mayor, Tim Bowles, the Tory, they eventually wrote, no, I'm not talking to you. I don't want to answer your questions. And I'm reminded of the old Highland saying. It's a very old Highland saying. To him that will not turn his back on friend or foe, that's a toast from the Highlands, from the clan days. You know, the old idea is that if you've got any guts as a politician, you don't just turn your back on journalists and say, I'm not going to answer your questions and I'm only going to talk to the cosy journalists who I'm friendly with at all. You know, you're there as someone who's confident in your own beliefs and that you can actually stand being questioned by a journalist like me or even questioned by you, Martin. And so I'm rather disgusted that we've got the two main candidates in the Bristol elections are now saying that they're turning their back on me. They don't want to speak. And why is that? It's because I'm going to ask them some really awkward questions that they might not be able to answer. Anyway, so we're now going to, after the music, we're going to hear some music now. We're going to be going over to Monaco in France, to the home of Alex Craner, to look at, and Alex is an investment manager, former hedge fund manager, who's written a book about the Cold War between Britain and Russia. And that will open up, I hope, a bit of a discussion about our own Mayor Marvin Rees's connections to Alexei Navalny, this figure of the West that is now supposed to be, one of the nemesises of Vladimir Putin, even though he's nothing of the sort. We're sold this nonsense in the press over here. As if it makes sense. It's kind of deluded and demented. But anyway, so let's hear a little bit of music now from 1968 and also something a bit more up to date from 2020.
Strange days, our tribe dies. I walked out, all the streets were empty. The government said everyone should stay home. Then they spread fear and loathing and no hope for the future. Not many did question this very strange move. Well, on the government website from the 21st of March 2020, it said COVID-19 was no longer high risk. Then 2 days later, they put us under lockdown. Then why are we not being told the truth by all the media outlets and the government lackeys? Why is this not big news? Why is it being ignored? Why no checks and balances? Why no second opinions? Why are they working? And why are we not? Said everyone should stay home. Then they spread fear and loathing, no hope for the future. Not many did question this very strange move. But on the government website from the 21st of March 2020, it says COVID-19 was no longer high risk. Then 2 days later, Boris put us under lockdown. Why are we not being told the truth by all the media outlets and the government lackeys? Why is this not big news? Why is it being ignored? Why no checks and balances? Why no second opinions? Why are they working? And why are we not? Why are they working? And why are we not? Why are they working? And why are we not? Why are they working? And why are we not? Why are they working? And why are we not? Why are they working? And why are we not?
Okay, so that's Van Morrison from last year. As I Walked Out, and before that you had The Doors from 1968 with Strange Days. And I'm joined on the line for not the BCFM Politics Show tonight from Monaco by Alex Craner. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you for having me. And hearty greetings to Bristol.
Okay, lovely, lovely to hear your voice, Alex. Anyway, look, it'd be lovely to just get your take from France and from Monaco, and maybe if you've been back to Croatia, on what's going on over here. Now, apparently, we've got a roadmap, whatever that means, to get out of all this by June, if we're lucky. But some other countries not so lucky, and some, like Belarus, I noticed have had protests where you have loads of people just start get a sound system and start dancing on a big intersection in the streets to protest. Now, that was apparently against the elections, but it's also just as good a way to protest against the lockdown if you wanted to.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, you know, here in Monaco, we have some kind of a soft version of the lockdowns. So nothing is locked down, but let's say that the restaurants work on a restricted basis. So you can go to a restaurant to have a meal. After the meal, you can have a coffee, but you cannot go to a restaurant just to have a coffee or just a beer. You have to eat, and then you can be served drinks, coffee, and so forth. And my understanding is that this has been a bit of a struggle between the palace government, the prince's government, and the French ministries. because I think that Prince Albert did not want to destroy the small businesses here. He didn't want them to lose the ability to function. So they continued working through the most recent round of lockdowns. And then what happened was that many people from the surrounding areas in France would come to Monaco to have their lunches and dinners and so forth. And then the people in the surrounding areas, you know, the restaurateurs were complaining that, like, how come they can work and we can't, and they're getting all our business and so forth. And then the French government apparently put pressure on Monaco government to further restrict things. And then the new rule was that, yeah, okay, you can do all these same things, but only if you're a resident of Monaco. So right now, I think the official rule is that if you're a resident in Monaco, you can go to a restaurant and have a meal, and things work kind of, you know, as usual, without being able to have just a coffee or just a beer or, you know, but only if you're a resident. So for non-residents, it's not available. I think it's not applied with great deal of strictness. Then further on, we have a curfew at 7 in the evening. So after 7 in the evening, everybody has to go home until, I think, 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And then we are obliged to wear masks everywhere out in the public, and they're enforcing that. But I have to say, in Monaco, the police are kind of polite, you know. So I go out without a mask all the time, and I decided that I would do that by pretending that I'm eating something, you know. So I would always walk out with a banana or an apple or something. But Monaco is a small place, and then eventually they kind of spot you. And like 3 or 4 weeks ago, I got confronted by a policewoman who said, like, I see you all the time, you never wear a mask, you never wear a mask, we can't have this. And then another two policemen showed up, and then they, you know, like, they were nice. They could have fined me, but they didn't. They just gave me a talking to. They said, like, well, you know, if everybody did like you, then nobody would be wearing a mask. And you understand we have to enforce this because blah, blah, blah. So anyway, you know, like, we have like a kind of a soft version of these lockdowns and restrictions. Life goes on, but it's very annoying. And, you know, I'm the wrong person to ask about this whole thing because, you know, I'm struggling to be polite about it because I belong to in the group of people that thought this whole thing has been a hoax since day one, since before the day one. And so I do not believe that there really is a health emergency. I don't believe that the lockdown measures are necessary. I don't think they're helpful for anything. I think we're looking at a whole different agenda that has nothing to do with public health. So, you know, even speaking about this in polite terms is an effort for me. And the thing that annoys me the most is that my children and all other children spend 8 hours in school wearing masks. And that's not very good for their health. That's not very good for anything. But basically, there's nothing we can do about this. In the beginning, in September, we tried to push back against the government a little bit to try to relax those rules. Unfortunately, there's nothing they can, you know, they can't do this because they are under pressure from higher instances, you know.
Okay, pressure. But Alex, I mean, yeah. Hundreds of thousands of people have died of this pandemic in Europe. Surely, I mean, you can't just say that didn't happen.
I don't know what they died of. Hundreds of thousands of people die every year. Did we have excess death? Did the death rates in society change? They didn't. So, you know, we have no flu anymore, right? Everything is COVID. It's COVID, COVID, COVID. Everything.
Well, hang on, because if you look at the death rates, certainly here in the UK, they definitely did go up at the beginning of last spring. But anyway, you know, your attitude to this, I mean, some people, I would say, even in Monaco, will say, well, Alex is putting everyone in danger by walking around pretending that there's nothing going on.
Well, there's 19 randomized controlled trials, so highest standard in scientific research into the efficacy of masks in preventing or slowing down viral infections. None of these 19 studies reached the conclusion that masks serve any purpose. However, one of these studies did come back with strong conclusion that it increases the risk of influenza-like illnesses and infections of respiratory pathways by 3 times. So the mask, extended use of mask, triples your risk of acquiring a respiratory infection or an influenza-like disease. So something that doesn't help stop the spread of viral infection, but does increase your risk of other diseases, to my mind, is not a good measure to stop the unhealthy people.
If what you're saying is true, why is everyone going around in masks? They're not here in Britain, by the way, outside. I mean, somebody somewhere at least has got a bit of common sense to say, well, there's no point in wearing a mask in the open air because actually the fresh air is good for you. It's inside that you might catch something. But anyway, what do you think's really going on if everyone is being forced by the police in France to do these things which you believe are completely unnecessary? What is going on?
I think there's a different agenda at play, and I think that the agenda at play is what they're calling the Great Reset or the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And this is an agenda that groups like the Davos Economic Forum are quite open and explicit about. It's not a conspiracy. They have laid it out in black and white. And this is a complete restructuring of the global economic and political establishment. And so these are changes that would not be possible to impose on a society in ordinary circumstances. So you need some kind of an emergency. You need a war emergency or you need a pandemic. And so the pandemics have been used for a very long time by totalitarian regimes to kind of push the whole society into fear, to force compliance with policies and measures that people would not normally accept. And you have empirical so if we go back to what I said about the masks, you said if what you're saying is true. No, what I'm saying is true because this is factual stuff that's very easy to find out. You know, you have
well,
all these.
Can I interrupt you there? Because sure. It's not that easy to find out. I put up an interview up online, which was a whole list of studies saying exactly that, what you've just been saying, which was actually in a book by Dr. Vernon Coleman saying proof that masks do more harm than good. That is the title of the book. It is available if you want to download it for free. He's made it available for free. But just simply by listing the studies and the details of those official studies which prove that point, that was then removed from the internet as misinformation by Google.
Well, I don't know what makes Google the authority on these things, because you have these studies on British Medical Journal, on Oxford Centers for Evidence-Based Medicine, and a whole bunch of other sites where these scientific studies are open and anybody can access them and read them. And so I don't think this is even controversial. These are measures that are forced down on us by government bureaucracies, they are promoted by media. But as the Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine said quite explicitly, the evidence that masks are efficient at preventing the spread of viral diseases is based on low quality scientific evidence, which is a polite way of saying junk science.
Okay, Martin Summers, can I ask you to come in and just give your comments on what Alex's saying there, particularly about masks, but also on the general idea that, you know, it might make it a lot easier to reorientate the world's finances if you've got some sort of global crisis going on, like a pandemic.
Yeah, and that implies that the pandemic may be a created pandemic. And as we've discussed on previous shows here, it's quite possible that it did come from the Wuhan laboratory. But of course, the Wuhan laboratory is partly funded by DARPA, which is the US Pentagon. And of course, what's happened in Southeast Asia is in China and Vietnam and Taiwan and New Zealand, their economies are now functioning. Nobody's wearing masks. But of course, they're not allowing anybody in or out. There's a big change going on in the global economy. Southeast Asia is on the rise, led by China. And of course, if the Pentagon had been successful in seeding a pandemic inside China, that would have knocked the Chinese economy out. But at the same time, of course, they're quite happy for it to flow back over their own economy, because in September last year, 2019, there was another credit crunch. And of course, the previous credit crunch in 2008, the banks had to go to the government to ask for money. But of course, in 2019, they already had the techniques ready to massively, ramp up quantitative easing, etc., without telling anybody what they were doing. And then the pandemic kicks in. Now, the pandemic could just be an accident that just happened. It could be a hoax entirely. But I would suggest that it's actually a biological warfare agent, and it's been seeded by the Pentagon initially in China. But the Chinese have worked out what's going on, and their economy is now back to normal. Nobody's
wearing masks. Same
in Vietnam.
Martin,
geopolitical enemies.
Martin, can you just address what Alex was saying about the curfews in France and the masks? Because I think this is something that I think over in the UK at the moment, we would, I think, be pretty annoyed if there was a curfew. That isn't going to stop the spread of the virus necessarily. It is going to drive people into homes and maybe sleepovers and that sort of thing. But a curfew is a military measure used in wartime.
Well, I mean, different countries have adopted different measures, as we know. I mean, in South Africa at one stage, they weren't allowing anybody to buy alcohol. I couldn't see what the justification was for that was in South Africa. I think whatever measures you do adopt, and countries have obviously adopted different measures in different places. The most successful countries in Southeast Asia haven't adopted general lockdown. They've isolated where the stuff came from, where people have, and then they've been very, very proactive in tracing people. I mean, my friend Shelley, who's working in Auckland at the moment in New Zealand, she went to Auckland. They found the two cases and they locked Auckland down for 3 days solidly. She was stuck in a B&B for 3 days. And they are basically making sure that nobody comes into the country with COVID. And lots of Southeast Asian countries are in a position where nobody has to wear masks. There is no lockdown, but nobody can go in and out of the country.
Okay,
and this,
well,
of course,
the
is a geopolitical challenge to the West.
The situation in these countries varies. Anyway, what do you make of what Martin's saying, Alex?
Well, I have to agree that everything he says is quite... It's quite possible, you know, whether the pandemic really happened or not. I don't know. I can't really tell, you know, what they tell us in the media and what actually happens is not necessarily the truth. You know, I've read that what happened in Italy was different from what happened in Iran. And this was different from what happened in China. There is a possibility that these were sorts of biological attacks. You know, I was very confused for a while about what happened in Italy, because I know people who told me of, you know, like having lost family members, having lost friends, acquaintances, relatives. And so something did happen. But then much later, I found out from a person who works near one of the hospitals in Bergamo. And he told me that he had a conversation with one of the doctors at one of these hospitals, And this doctor told him that, like, when the pandemic started, the government issued a protocol that anybody who came to the hospital with symptoms resembling COVID-19, that the medical staff and the doctors had to follow this particular protocol, and they couldn't just treat them the way it seemed fit to them. So they couldn't do what they as doctors would do, exercise their judgment and prescribe a treatment that they would normally prescribe. They had to follow the government protocol. And that protocol was very aggressive with the use of these ventilators. And apparently the ventilators killed a lot of people that didn't have to die, you know, because apparently what he told me was that if you take a completely healthy person and put them on the ventilator full power, the person has 50-50 chance of surviving that. That's such a
well, that's absolutely that's fascinating. And you know, we're going to hear now a little clip and it's an interview with the actor Louis Gossett Jr. He survived COVID-19. He was one of the stars. He played the sergeant major or whatever they have in the U.S. Army in the film An Officer and a Gentleman. And he actually demanded ivermectin. He was very sick. He was getting more ill. We'll have a listen first to a short clip of him in the film, An Officer and a Gentleman. And then let's hear from the words from the mouth of Louis Gossett Jr. himself, who recovered after having ivermectin treatment.
You better stop eyeballing me, boy. You're not worthy enough to look your superiors in the eye. Use your peripheral vision. Understand?
Yes, sir.
Now, every time I say understand, I want the whole group to say, yes, sir. Understand?
Yes, sir.
Understand?
Yes, sir.
I felt that something was wrong. I could hardly breathe. And slowly but surely, I got sicker and sicker. I was diagnosed, of course, as COVID. And they put me in this emergency ward. And I looked in the eyes of the doctors and the nurses, and they were so tired and so stressed out. And I looked around the room and I said, this might be the last room I'll be on Earth. Let me get out of here. So I fought it day and night. And I got this avalanche of well wishes. I was blown away. I was touched. People around the world, I called them angels. And one of those angels, it called and said, I have something for you. So I took it because I had nothing really to lose. I was desperate. I needed to find something, but I couldn't walk. To make a long story short, here I am sitting here telling you my story in pretty nice health, that ivermectin interrupted a process that was doing me harm. And ivermectin is one of those things that's already been here. We use it now for the conquering of COVID-19. I'm very grateful for all of you for literally saving my life.
So that's the voice of Louis Gossett Jr. there. The actor plays the officer, whatever he is, Sergeant Major type figure in the American Army, in An Officer and a Gentleman. He believes his life was saved by ivermectin. One does have to wonder, considering what you just said, Alex, is if there has been some sort of medical dictatorship going on here with wrong information, either deliberately or otherwise. And it'd be interesting to hear what you've got to say on that being given to medical professionals, not just in Italy, but in many countries where they were trying to treat people for pneumonia, where they didn't have pneumonia at all. They had something called SARS-CoV-2, which ivermectin is the basic treatment for. It was discovered back in 2003 in the first SARS outbreak, that ivermectin cures this stuff pretty much. You get something like 80 to 90% recovery rate, particularly when it's given at an early stage. And yet ivermectin and chloroquine, particularly in France, chloroquine was prevented from using. The government came up back in January 2020 and banned the stuff, so you couldn't buy it over the counter anymore. So this definitely seems to be something going on here where governments have been being used by people behind the scenes, the pharmaceutical industry or somebody, in order to increase and exacerbate the problem, almost to create this chaos.
I think so. I think, however, that the agenda goes beyond the pharmaceutical companies. You know, from the very beginning, for my own reasons, I've done a lot of research on the immune system generally, And you know, there are certain very obvious things if there's going to be a threat to public health. And so, you know, there are things that are known to have very strong impact on people's immune systems. Simple things like vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin A, sleep, adequate sleep, exercise, fresh air, sunlight. Adequate sleep has an enormous impact on people's immune system. So, you know, if there was a public health care and our public health officials came out and said, like, okay, right, we're going to have this pandemic. Apparently, we don't know, maybe it's a dangerous bug. We suggest that everybody eats well, gets their loads of vitamins, minerals, make sure to eat well, make sure you get plenty of sleep and exercise, try to avoid stress and so forth. Then I would think, okay, so they're concerned about our health, and these are very sensible recommendations. Also, we know that ivermectin can lower the mortality from COVID-19 by, I think, the figure is 76%. We also know from empirical, very recent empirical data that hydroxychloroquine has reduced mortality from late-stage COVID patients by more than 50%. And if used in combination with zinc and some antibiotic, I think the figure goes up to close to 80%. So it's very strange that these very effective, safe, cheap, and widely available medicines suddenly become controversial, that you can't practically mention them. When Donald Trump began to mention hydroxychloroquine way back in the beginning of March last year, the media went into a hysteria, ridiculing him and saying he's putting people's life in danger and so forth, to the point where I think in Australia, in Victoria, I think a doctor, if they prescribe hydroxychloroquine, can actually go to prison. So something is not right. And I think that it's obvious to everyone that something is not right. But for some reason, people are afraid to speak out. Everybody is afraid to voice their most common sense observation. We've gone, each of us, through a lifetime of cold epidemics, flu epidemics. We've seen this. This one's not so different than all the other ones. Why this drastic, highly destructive, counterproductive response, and why this fanatical adherence to measures that are on their face incoherent and inefficient, ineffective. And so the other thing that I was going to mention at this point is that there's a long history of using epidemics of infectious disease as a cover for authoritarian political agendas. And there's actually good empirical data on this. And there was one or two papers published in the PLOS journal. I don't know what PLOS stands for, but basically the title of the paper is Pathogens and Politics: Further Evidence That Parasite Prevalence Predicts Authoritarianism. And so this is a very extensive bit of research. And what they show is that the correlation between the prevalence of infectious epidemics and authoritarian political agendas is 70%. And this in social scientists is spectacularly high correlation. This is like higher correlation than correlation between IQ and test scores. So this was just a spectacular finding. And I think we shouldn't shrink from questioning whether this particular pandemic, which was also unjustified as a, you know, World Health Organization declaring the pandemic, it was completely unjustified, whether this pandemic is actually a cover for the, you know, the global ruling parasites unfolding and, you know, ushering a new authoritarian regimes on previously democratic societies.
Yeah, the predator classes, some people call them, and a new world order. Are we allowed to use the term new world order?
Am I? Well, I'm allowed to use whatever I want. You know, people don't have to agree with me, but I can claim freedom of speech for myself. So I'll say what I want to say, and people are free to disagree. And I'm actually happy for people to disagree, because if I'm wrong about something, I'd rather know than be stupid. But we're not going to get out of this unless we speak out freely and openly what's on our minds, what our impressions are, what we gather from our surroundings. You know, we have to speak it openly. And so, you know, the heavy censorship that's come with this pandemic is another, let's say, corroborating factor that we're actually dealing with the totalitarian agenda.
Okay, so that's it for the time being, talking about the pandemic. We will probably return to that. But one of the main reasons I asked you to come and speak to us, Alex, is because of our mayor. He chose last weekend to come out in support of Alexei Navalny, his brave friend, he called him, who's this figure that's been in the news constantly over the last year or so, and particularly recently with this alleged poisoning with Novichok in his underpants. Now, whether you quite believe this is a whole other question, but I thought we'd have a listen now. We had a listen to a short clip last week, and there's a different clip this week from Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, who also went to Yale and where he met Alexei Navalny, giving him this amazing kind of character reference, completely out of the blue, almost as if Alexei Navalny desperately needed someone to say that they thought that he was a great guy, even though he's a racist. And our local mayor here, Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor, obliged. So let's have a listen now to another clip from the Sky interview. And I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So you can listen to the whole thing, because it really is quite, I found it absolutely incredible. And the amazing thing, of course, is that our local press is not reporting on this at all, even though the mayor has endorsed a racist. Even I would have thought that was quite an interesting story. So let's have a listen now to Marvin Rees's character reference for his brave friend Alexei Navalny.
How have you been able to offer your support? I understand that he wrote to you after he'd been poisoned. Is that right?
Well, there's a small group of us, Mayakel from Lebanon, Sergei in Germany, Ted, who's in the US, along with Emma Sky, who's the director of World Fellows, and a number of us come together and say, how can we support Alexei and his family? Remember, he's got two children and a wife at this time as well. And yeah, I was just looking back from my emails the other day, and as he came out of the poisoning, he just dropped a note saying, thank you for the support to all of us. And I just dropped him another email the other day. He won't be able to read it now, but once he comes out of prison, he will be able to pick it up. So we are continually just reaching out, seeing how we can support the family, trying to take that pressure off him as much as we can, and to let him know we're here, and to let him and the Russian leaders know that the world is watching.
And as we heard from our correspondent in Moscow, more protests out on the streets today, supporting Yulia, as you say, his wife. How do you think all of this is going to pan out in future months?
I have no idea. You know, I'm minded of what Vaclav Havel said some years ago, in that political systems can look incredibly powerful until they're no longer powerful, and you realise just how fragile they were if you build up a system based on untruths. And so it looks insurmountable. People incredibly brave going onto the streets and being arrested. We want peace, obviously. We want justice. But I've no idea how this is going to go. But I think one thing is for sure, in that the integrity and commitment and bravery of Alexei is being shown on the world stage. And the opposite spirit of some of those who have been trying to kill him has also been put on show in the world stage. And then it's up for the world and the Russian people themselves to judge.
And do you dare to hope that one day you can welcome him to Bristol and show him around your city?
Well, that's the diary appointment we have booked on hold at the moment. When I was running in 2016 for mayor, my campaign coordinator said, Marvin, you just had a text from some guy with over a million Twitter followers. I don't know who this guy is. And it was Alexei saying, good luck in Bristol. And then just a little exchange of emails. And he said, you know, Marvin, looking forward to coming to Bristol. I need you to show me around. And that's the promise. And that's the tour I hope I get to give.
Yeah, well, if it happens, let us know. We'll come and meet you as well. Marvin Rees, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, well, that's glorious Sky News there. If you can ever be bothered to watch it, you know. But there they are talking to our Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees, talking about these building up systems of untruths, Marvin. Well, you know all about that, don't you? And your closeness to the big property speculators in the city, even though you pretend to be a Labour mayor. Maybe Martin will hear from you first about this, because you know, we did touch on it last week with Kevin Cahill, but it is quite incredible that Marvin has voluntarily outed himself as a supporter of Alexei Navalny. We've also heard this week that Amnesty have dropped him as a prisoner of conscience after videos circulating all around the world and tens of thousands of emails and letters to Amnesty saying this guy should never be a prisoner of conscience. Look at his racist attitudes.
Yeah, well, I understand that Marvin met Alexei Navalny when he was on a scholarship at Yale. And, of course, these scholarships at Yale are given to up-and-coming political figures from around the world who are going to be movers and shakers going forward. And that's why they get their brought, you know, that's why the money is provided by corporate America and by the US government to give these, you know, to get these people to meet each other under their auspices. And it's a kind of form of soft power.
Well, they're tapped up, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if you get offered a free years at Yale, paid for by whoever, you know, and of course, you know, people who go on these courses are, you know, then, you know, that's a great thing to have on your CV. And of course, that's where they're all schmoozed together. And of course, that then pays off later on when Alexei Navalny is in Russia, you know, in combat, as it were, with the current government in Russia. And he's got all of these chums around the world that he met at Yale who can all vouch for him, etc. And of course, as you say, Amnesty International had initially adopted him as a prisoner of conscience. They haven't adopted Julian Assange, by the way, which is extraordinary if you think about it. But Alexei Navalny, but of course, Alexei Navalny is a populist politician in Russia. He called people from the Caucasus cockroaches. And because a lot of the immigration into Russia proper in Moscow and St. Petersburg and places like that are coming from the Caucasus. They are the kind of, you know, the other to the Russian nationalist mentality. And of course, Navalny wants to kind of be a good Russian. So he said, you know, cockroaches, they're cockroaches, and you'd normally you would hit them with a shoe. I would prefer to use a pistol. So, of course, he's appealing there to right-wing Russian nationalist sentiment. But at the same time, of course, he presents himself in the West as a liberal and so on. And, of course, this whole thing about him being poisoned with Novichok in his underpants, Navalny's pretty clearly, to my mind, working closely with MI6. The Novichok that was supposedly found on a bottle originally, a water bottle, was actually only discovered by a military laboratory in Germany. And of course, a lot of this has got to do with the elections to the Duma that are coming up in September, where it's likely that Putin's party United Russia will win. And of course, the other thing is the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is nearing completion to bring natural gas to Germany directly from Russia. And of course, the Americans and the British are determined to sabotage that. And then I would suggest that Navalny, he also had while he was in Germany, he went to Austria, and then they made a film about Putin's supposed palace in the Black Sea region. And it was actually, you know, it was a professionally made film. And of course, they've used things like the Integrity Initiative and so on to push all of this out there. And it's actually been pretty much debunked on Russian national television. It's actually a hotel. It hasn't been completed yet. And it's owned by a business person who has got some links to Vladimir Putin. But, I mean, we're not hearing very much about Biden's son's relationships with Burisma in Ukraine, etc. I mean, basically, most politicians have got some pretty dirty connections, and Navalny's no exception.
Alex, what I know about Navalny, twice convicted fraudster. He's in two big privatizations that went on in the 1990s under Yeltsin in Russia. One was the State Forestry Service, and the other one was the State Post Office, obviously very sensitive. Now, he's now, as Martin was saying, you know, he's coming out with this racist stuff, and he's connected to our mayor through Yale. Who is this guy, Alexei Navalny? Because I understand also that he's also quite friendly with one of the oligarchs called Khodorkovsky, who's had to flee Russia and is now sitting there very wealthy, but he's campaigning sort of remotely from Switzerland.
I actually don't know very much about his relationship to Khodorkovsky, but I know that Navalny was a very young activist in the Grigory Yavlinsky's party, Yabolka, which means apple. They're like an opposition party. Grigory Yavlinsky was the economist who produced the 500-day transition plan for Russia to transition from communism to capitalism under Boris Yeltsin at the very beginning. He created this plan in collaboration with a bunch of Harvard academics. And this whole thing turned out a complete disaster. According to Russian investigations, Navalny was recruited then by one Bill Browder, the former hedge fund manager of a hedge fund called Hermitage Capital Management. And he was recruited by Bill Browder in 2006. And Bill Browder was kicked out of Russia in 2006. And apparently Bill Browder's intention with Navalny was to train him in the so-called Hermitage effect. And so what Bill Browder was doing while he was managing this hedge fund in Russia was he was doing basically activist investing. He would try to buy up as many shares as possible of various companies like Gazprom, VTB Bank, Sberbank, Lukoil, and so forth. And then he would use the media. He would research the corruption in these companies, and then he would use the media, like Russian media, like Financial Times, like Wall Street Journal, to expose this corruption. And then, by exposing the corruption, what tended to happen as a rule is that Vladimir Putin's government would step in and clean up. Right? They would sack the corrupt management. They would change the laws to disable the corruption and so forth. And then the share prices of these companies would increase dramatically. This happened several times, and so this was a big money making scheme for Bill Browder. And apparently he recruited Alexei Navalny to kind of continue this Hermitage effect procedure of researching and exposing corruption. And so Alexei Navalny became this public figure, a blogger, a filmmaker, who continued doing this. So this is the allegation of the Russian investigation. And to me, it rings true because I know about Bill Browder's Hermitage effect activist investing. And this is essentially what Alexei Navalny was doing. Well, the problem here is that Bill Browder was part of a large network, I think connected with either MI6 or the CIA or both or whatever. Bill Browder himself when he was asked in a Vanity Fair interview a few years ago, the interview asked him point blank, are you MI6? And rather than saying, no, I'm not, Bill Browder kind of gave a non-denial answer, saying like, well, I don't know, really, you know, I work with so many other people, it's hard to say who's who, you know. And so it's a credible thing. So Navalny was financed by Bill Browder, apparently. And he was also put in touch with this other guy, Ashurkov, who became part of his organization and who was recently busted trying to raise $10 to $20 million from MI6 in order to destabilize Russia and to try to do favorable things for Western financial interests. You know, he was saying like, well, $10 to $20 million is not a lot. It could be billions for, you know, the Western financiers.
Well, this Navalny scandal has not escaped the notice in Brussels. I noticed that the Irish MEP, Claire Daly, she is a MEP for the Independence for Change party. So she's a sort of, you know, she's not part, one of the major Irish parties. But anyway, she brought up this whole business of Russophobia and Navalny in the European Parliament last week. And so let's have a listen to Claire Daly now talking about Navalny, as she believes is a racist, basically.
Listening to the relentless Russophobia in this place, why are people surprised that Russia sees no point in engaging with the EU? I'm as happy as anybody else to stand up for anybody's rights, including Navalny's. But let's be honest about him. He's a vicious, anti-immigrant racist on maybe 4% of the support, in rallying hundreds and thousands in cities of millions, hardly a mass movement. And we wouldn't be discussing him at all if he'd been arrested anywhere else other than in Russia. Meanwhile, Julian Assange has been incarcerated for almost 10 years for exposing US war crimes. We can't mention his name. Tomorrow, Pablo Hasél, a Catalan rapper, is going to prison for his lyrics. Where's the call to sanction Spain? Tomorrow, 62-year-old Claire Grady is going to prison in West Virginia for her role in the non-violent plowshare action against Trident. Where's the demand to break off links with the US, or the outcry about the hundreds of people arrested in this city on a protest a week ago? Nowhere, because this isn't about human rights. This is a geopolitical agenda against Russia, fueled by a military-industrial complex who need an enemy to justify their millions. Of course you're right to go to Russia. We should be engaged in dialogue, not war.
That's the Irish MEP from the Independence for Change party, Claire Daly, there speaking the other week or last week in the European Parliament. Now, Alex, this, where do you think this is all heading? Because I know you've done a book. I'm trying to remember the title of it. I think, isn't it The Great Deception?
Correct.
About this whole business of the attacks on Russia, and we've got more news this week that the Western news services have actually been partaking in deliberate propaganda campaigns against Russia. But I'm worried about the particularly about the Magnitsky Acts passed first by Obama in the US and then in the UK, which actually mean that if a Russian business person, or actually any Russian citizen potentially, visits the West, they can have their visas withdrawn a moment's notice and actually then be arrested. So this is having a massive chilling effect on Russian business people's ability to actually make deals and even travel to the West.
These types of legislations have been the work of the man I mentioned previously, Bill Browder. So he was the man who lobbied through the U.S. Congress in 2012 the so-called Magnitsky Act, Magnitsky Act legislation is being replicated in many countries in the West, like in European Union, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth. Ostensibly, it's a human rights legislation, so they are using it to sanction people who are deemed to have infringed on human rights in their countries in some way, but particularly Russia. But it's actually an abomination of law, because it does not foresee any kind of a due process. So as you mentioned, somebody can just at a moment's notice and without recourse have their assets in the West frozen and their visas rescinded. And this comes generally from the bowels of the bureaucracy in the particular case of the United States. It comes from the U.S. Treasury Department. So some unnamed, faceless official from the U.S. Treasury Department can put anybody, essentially, because it's not just Russian citizens who are and Russian companies who are targets of this, but now it's pretty much global. They can just put you on a list of sanctioned persons, and that's it. You can no longer travel to the United States or whichever country that sanctions you in this way, and your assets can be frozen from one day to the next, and you have no recourse, and you cannot defend yourself. You cannot know your accuser. You cannot know what you're being accused of. That's just it. So that act, the Magnitsky Act, is deemed as the opening salvo of the new Cold War between the West and Russia. And why we should have war, cold or hot, between the West and Russia, that is the thing that nobody seems to be asking that question. And it seems that in the West, everybody just kind of takes it for granted that, of course, you know, Russia is bad and we have to be, we have to maintain a hostile stance against Russia. The reasons for that actually are interesting to consider, because they go way back in history. They go back maybe 200 years or more. And I think that if you, it basically has to do with the logic of empire. So, you know, a global empire cannot tolerate any rivals. So if any country emerges that's powerful enough to say no, it has to be destroyed, it has to be destabilized, it has to be regime changed. And but perhaps the objective in doing this on the targeting Russia is, I think the earliest formulation was by Sir Halford Mackinder, who basically, his concrete statement in the 1919 document called Democratic Ideals and Reality. So he says that who rules East Europe commands the heartland. Who rules the heartland commands the world island. And who rules the world island controls the world. And world island being Eurasia. And so this theme goes straight through till today. And so Zbigniew Brzezinski said that whoever wins Eurasia rules the world. And then as recently as 2018, you had Wes Mitchell, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. So he was the successor to Victoria Nuland. He delivered a statement to the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee and basically said flat out that the central aim of the administration's foreign policy was to defend U.S. domination of Eurasian landmass as the foremost United States national security interest and to prepare the nation for this challenge. And as part of this objective, he said that confronting Russia would be among the highest priorities for the Bureau, being his Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, and that all 50 U.S. missions in Europe and Eurasia were required to develop, coordinate, and execute tailored action plans for rebuffing Russian influence operations in their host countries. So I think that, you know, this is the overarching objective that probably has spawned things like the Skripal affair, Navalny poisoning, Navalny recruitment by Bill Browder. Bill Browder's investing in Russia. All of these tactics, all of these schemes, actually, I think, have the ultimate objective of regime changing Russia, destabilizing Russia, because the logic of empire is that it cannot stand rivals. If a country is powerful enough to resist the dictate of the empire, it has to be cut down to size. And
well,
so
that's
certainly
what they're doing, trying to cut the Russians down to size. Fascinating article on the Grey Zone this week. Reuters, the BBC and Bellingcat participated in a secret UK Foreign Office funded program to weaken Russia, reveal leaked documents. So this is Max Blumenthal in the Grey Zone. UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office sponsored Reuters and the BBC to conduct a series of covert programs aimed at promoting regime change inside Russia and undermining its government across Eastern Europe and Central Asia, according to a series of leaked documents. Obviously, I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The leaked materials show Thomson Reuters Foundation and BBC Media Action participating in a covert information warfare campaign aimed at countering Russia, working through a shadowy department within the UK Foreign Office known as the Counter Disinformation and Media Development Department, CDMD. So that's a hell of a misnomer there. I don't know how they managed to say the Counter Disinformation. I don't know how anyone managed to tick that one off. The media organisations operated alongside a collection of intelligence contractors in a secret entity known simply as the Consortium. Through training programs of Russian journalists overseen by Reuters, the Foreign Office sought to produce an attitudinal change in the participants, promoting a positive impact on their perception of the UK. So this goes on and on, this a very fascinating article about how the mass media is being used. So, Alex, I mean, think this is quite incredible. It's like that there's no way for the empire to subdue Russia militarily. That's impossible. Well, what they can do is just kind of point the finger at them and make everybody in the West feel like the Russians are terrible.
Well, yeah, that's correct. And then, you know, preferably they would probably like to make the Russians feel that Russia is terrible and that they need better leadership, more democracy, greater prosperity and so forth.
That's right.
And I think that they are trying to be very active in this respect. And, you know, you're right. It's you know, when you take a very, very powerful military like the U.S. military and they cannot even, you know, secure Iraq or even, you know, like they're huddled there in the green zone, it's clear that, you know, you cannot rule such large landmass like Eurasia by military conquest. So the preferred tactic is what they've done for the last 200 years, and that's to keep all their rivals weak, divided, destabilized, and then to create these little divisions like, you know, Russia, Ukraine, India, Pakistan, China, Taiwan, where you can always pit one side against the other, where you can encourage both sides to engage in a war where they exhaust themselves and demoralize themselves, and they're constantly weak. Because I think the Western Empire is the bankers' empire, and the bankers want basically all these nations' resources as collateral, and their populations as cheap labor force. That's the whole idea, and this is, I think, the logic of what they're trying to achieve in Russia, in China.
And in the background to all of that, of course, we've seen this week all the main news outlets reporting a German court sending a message to Syria on war crimes. German court convicting the former Syrian official of crimes against humanity, a Syrian ex-intelligence officer convicted for torture, and yet still no convictions for Bush or Blair. I mean, this seems to me to be the only thing they can do now. The Western oligarchy is really to, you know, make sure there are lots of stories printed about their enemies which are negative, try and demoralise them, because they can't actually beat them. Martin, what do you make of what we've been saying?
Well, I think the analysis by Alex is pretty accurate. If we look at what happened in the Ukraine in 2014, you got pro-EU demonstrators who were clearly being manipulated by outside intelligence agencies. There's a mass demonstration in the Maidan Square. Snipers open up, kill 80-plus people, all professional snipers who carried out a professional job. Everybody was shot in the head by same caliber weaponry. The Russian secret services leaked a telephone conversation between Umas Pirts, who was the Estonian ambassador. He was phoning Catherine Ashton, an ex-Labour politician who was the EU's foreign affairs head, and he said to her on the telephone, "I've just been around the hospitals, and all of these people have been shot by professionals, but these professionals are not connected to the Yanukovych regime, the regime that was pushed out. They're connected with the incoming regime." And Catherine Ashton goes, "Gosh, really?" And of course, there's been a court case in Kiev since then, where the Berkut riot police were charged with assassinating the people on the demonstration. They were able to win. They left the court free. They were found not guilty because some of the snipers themselves actually testified on video from Georgia. They were professional snipers that had been brought into Ukraine by Shakashvili, who's a pro-Western politician in Georgia, and that was subsequently became a politician in Ukraine. And they were all working together, probably paid by British and US taxpayer dollars, to shoot pro-EU demonstrators. Because, you know, in other words, they're quite capable of killing people from their own side in order to make these goals to be fulfilled. And of course, Western intelligence services have been engaged in false flag terrorism for decades in Western Europe and elsewhere. And of course, most people are blissfully unaware of that. They see a few James Bond films at Christmas and they think that that's what the intelligence world is all about. In actual fact, the Russian intelligence services, Chinese intelligence services are very well aware that NATO intelligence services, for example, are behind ISIS and Al-Qaeda, working with the Saudi Mukhabarat for many, many years, decades. But nevertheless, the kind of Alice in Wonderland world we live in, political opinion is very easily manipulated.
And of course,
it's great that, you know, the Labour mayor of Bristol, black mayor of Bristol, no doubt believes that the Russians are the evil ones who tried to kill Navalny. And of course, he doesn't know anything about the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980 or the assassinations in Kiev in 2014. Outside of his frame of reference.
Martin, the Grey Zone reported in October last year, 2020, on leaked materials released by Anonymous, which exposed a massive propaganda campaign funded by the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office to cultivate support for regime change in Syria. Soon yes. after, the Foreign Office claimed its computer systems had been penetrated by hackers, thus confirming their authenticity. The new leaks, though, and like I say, I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where you can also subscribe to get an weekly email of the show. The new leaks illustrate in alarming detail how Reuters and the BBC, two of the largest and most distinguished, I think there needs to be some inverted commas on there, news organisations in the world, attempted to answer the British Foreign Ministry's call for help in improving its ability to respond and promote our message across Russia and counter the Russian government's narrative. Their stated goals were to weaken the Russian state's influence over its near neighbours. It just seemed incredible, Alex, that these big news organisations, it's maybe not quite so incredible. I look at bulletins, particularly to do with the pandemic, that we're getting across the Western mass media and think, well, that bulletin may as well have been written by the pharmaceutical lobby. That bulletin may as well have been written by the arms lobby. The next bulletin may have been written by the Israel lobby, etc. So the journalism, the interrogative journalism, seems to have almost vanished.
I think that's pretty clear. And I think that thankfully most people by today realize this, and maybe it's not most people, but I think it's a far larger percentage of people than maybe was the case 20 years ago when, you know, like the global war on terror began, and when we had the wars in the Balkans. I think that today people are far better equipped to see through these basically propaganda narratives that are being forced on us. And you can tell the health stuff is written by pharmaceutical lobby, the banking stuff is written by banking lobby, the military industrial. So yeah, you're correct. But I'm a little bit more optimistic that us having these kinds of conversations and people hearing this and doing their own research and, you know, sharing information between themselves, that ultimately this is going to fall flat on its face. And already I can tell you that when I wrote Grand Deception about Bill Browder, there was a, you know, he was pretty much being, everywhere he went, he was being hailed as a hero, as this fighter for human rights and justice and anti-corruption and so forth. I think the wheels have come off of his whole bandwagon. And I think that many people today see him for the devious crook that he is.
Okay, so we've been talking a bit about Navalny and Marvin Rees. Now, what about another person whose their fame and fortune is based up from Yale University? I came across this article last week, thanks to one of the correspondents from sending it in. And of course, if you think we're missing anything on here, do please get in touch by whatever means, either commenting on the page, but the easiest way to do it is just email me. And this is an edition of the Yale Daily News, which exposed in the 1980s, I think this is, Yale Group Spurs Mao's emergence. And as they go on to explain in the Yale Daily News, Yale has helped many young men begin their political rise to power. In the class of 1919, in addition to the 1,000 male leaders graduating in New Haven, Yale in China was helping a young man by the name of Mao Zedong. So Yale from the 1901 had what it called a missionary society over in China, which it then changed its name to Yale in China. William Buckley was not the only Yale figure connected with the presidential trip to China. They're talking there about a presidential trip in 1972 with Bill Buckley and Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, which, by the way, was one of the things which it sparked off about 10 years later, or maybe 15 years later, the one-child policy. Without Yale's support, Mao Zedong may never have risen from obscurity to command China. Jonathan Spence, who's a professor of Chinese history, he's a Brit actually, I think he's at New York University now, was the first to discover Mao Zedong's connection with Yale. The professor noted in 1919 Mao, aged 26, was in Changsha, having finished his middle school education. He visited Peking and while there received a serious introduction to communist theory in a Marxist study group. Now, if he wanted to develop a reputation in socialist circles, he had to find a forum to propagate his views. At this crucial point, the Student Union of Yale in China invited Mao to take over the editorialship of their journal. He accepted the position and changed the format of the student magazine. It would now deal with social criticism and current problems and focus on thought reorientation. Well, how about that in Xinjiang today? Mao travelled to Peking and studied Marxist theory. In Shanghai, he met Cheng Tuhu, I can't pronounce that, who later became the leader of the Chinese Communist Party. Mao was told to form an area branch, but he had neither funds nor a meeting place. Once again, Yale stepped in, recalled Spence. The Medical College of Yale in China agreed to rent him three rooms, which Mao named his culture bookshop. And then he started various other bookshops around China. So I found it quite fascinating that Chairman Mao, Alex, had this connection back to Yale too.
Yeah, this is vaguely familiar to me, although maybe not the connection between Yale and Mao. But I've also noticed that a lot of these communist totalitarian leaders around the world were actually educated and funded from the West. The case was Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky. Then also, I think Pol Pot came from the had been educated in the West. I forget if it was London or Paris. Ayatollah Khomeini was spent time in Paris, I think, before he led the Iranian Revolution. So I think that the West does have a little bit of practice of incubating these revolutionaries who then go to, well, back to countries.
I love the way you use the word incubate, because isn't it Winston Churchill who famously said about Lenin's train that went into the start of the Russian Revolution? I think it was a second attempt, wasn't it? But anyway, he said it was like a plague bacillus being sent into the country. But anyway, look, yeah. Whilst talking about Yale, you cannot talk about Yale without looking at the Skull and Bones, because this is one of the most hideous organizations on the planet. And so we're going to hear now a short clip from Professor Anthony Sutton talking about what Skull and Bones is. It's this basically kind of, it looks like it's a normal fraternity, only it isn't. It's certainly looking particularly peculiar, and with the Skull and Crossbones logo giving it these satanic overtones. So let's have a listen now to Professor Anthony Sutton talking in the 1980s. He was, I think, at the Hoover Institute at the time, a Brit over in the United States, explaining all about Skull and Bones.
I received some of their internal documents, enough for me to put together the way they correspond with each other, the operations within the order, to some extent their problems, and to some extent their objectives.
Now this is the book, An Introduction to the Order, by Anthony C. Sutton. It has a skull and bones on the front and 322.
The 322 is an identification. The order has a temple on the Yale campus.
A
temple, yes. It's a building, maybe this 50, 60 feet by 40 feet, maybe 40 feet high. There's no windows, two big steel doors. We know what the temple looks like because back in 1880s, a number of Yale students became a little unhappy about what was going on inside this temple. When they went by it at midnight, sometimes they heard strange noises and all kinds of rumors on the Yale campus as to what this might be. There was a break-in. I call it the Yale Gate. there was a break-in to the temple, and the students who broke in cataloged what they found, and they made a drawing, a design of the interior of the temple. And three of the rooms are numbered. One is 322, one is 323, and one is 324. 322 is also, I suspect, the chapter number. And also in correspondence between members, they conclude their correspondence, where you and I would conclude yours truly or yours sincerely. They conclude yours in 322. Why 322? There are several theories for this. One is that the order originated with Demosthenes the Greek in 322 BC. That's one theory. Another one is that it stems from the founding date in the United States, which was 1832. So really we have the last two numbers, 32, the second chapter, founded in 1832. The skull and crossbones are prominent in their ceremonies, initiation ceremonies.
This is a symbol of death. Now, why would they take a symbol of death?
Yes, from what I understand, when a new member is initiated, that would be in the senior year at Yale, he's placed within a coffin.
Oh, my.
And now, we only know this from the Yale Gate papers. I call it Yale Gate. And from the photographs we have of members inside the temple, Many of these photographs are the 15 sitting around a table, and they have the skull and the crossbones sitting on the table in front of them. It is the symbol of death, and it has been called the Brotherhood of Death, and I think it probably more adequately should be called the Brotherhood of Death. So what I've had to do is look at the history, the biographies of the leading members of the order, and reconstruct their career and see if there's a common pattern in their careers. While doing that, I came across some interesting documents. Some members apparently are not too happy once they become involved with us after 10 or 20 years. One member in particular left a memorandum. He wrote it in 1932. He was buried away in his papers. I don't think anybody found it before I did. And it was a six-page memorandum on the order naming some of the members, and said it was the most sordid thing ever happened in the history of man. So, but to come back to my point, I have to reconstruct the objectives. What are the objectives? In the words of one member, might is right. If you have the power, you use it to achieve your objectives. What is the objective? As you look at the histories of individual members, it can only be one thing: to acquire power, to keep power, to use power for their own purposes.
So there's Professor Anthony Sutton there talking a bit about Yale. Martin, what do you make of this? Because as Alex is saying, there seems to be quite a lot of these little incubators around in the West. If you go back, to before the Russian Revolution, for example, as well. So these revolutions, although they appear just to happen, there may actually be, some sort of objective behind them. I mean, obviously, in order to control Russia after at the end of communism, it was a wonderful ruse in order to privatize everything and sell it off for hardly any money at all to Western business people.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends how far you want to go back with this. As Alex pointed out, historically there's been hostility towards Russia from Britain going back to the 18th, 19th century, the Great Game.
Sorry to interrupt you, but there's another reason for this. I mean, we talked about this with Kevin last week, and that is that one thing we know through our contacts is that the Russians have got a tremendous amount of intelligence that they gathered in the 1980s, 90s, etc. Well, maybe not so much in the 90s, about child sexual abuse in the British establishment, which they haven't used. And if that is the case, then of course the British establishment are extremely afraid of what the Russians know about them and would just want to shut them. Most of the Western intelligence services work very, very closely together, and so nothing is ever going to get out through the media, but it may well do come through Russia. And that's another reason why right now they may be very much afraid of what the Russians know about the Western establishment.
Well, we can look at it in the long perspective for 200 years, or we can bring it closer up to date. I mean, the fact that they're trying to cultivate all of these different potential clients doesn't surprise me at all in the past or even now. Let's try and narrow it down to something, to the more recent history, which is, of course, the 1990s in Russia, the Yeltsin era, when the tanks were sent in to suppress the Russian parliament, the Duma. And of course, there's a Duma election coming up in September in Russia. And that people in Russia, I was in Russia at the time, during the 90s, the social structure was completely destroyed. It was totally destructive, pointless shock therapy, which really was idiotic. And of course, that Russia has only recovered from that by stopping doing the silly things that they were being told to do by economists like Jeffrey Sachs, again, from Yale. And of course, most people in the West have basically forgotten all about that. And they seem to presume that the people in Russia have forgotten about it. And this is the problem for people like Navalny, as was pointed out earlier by the woman in the European Parliament. The actual opinion polls give him something between 2 and 5% support and his faction. And that's because they are seen as stooges of the Yeltsin era, and that's which was certainly disastrous for ordinary people in Russia. And Navalny has got some support, but it's not enough to breach the 5% barrier. I suspect that what will happen in September is he won't be allowed to stand, but others similar to him will, Senya Sobchak and others like her. They won't probably reach 5%, which means they won't be represented in the parliament. United Russia is more than likely to get 50%. They might get less, but if they do, they will form alliances with other political forces we hear nothing about. The Communist Party are the second biggest political force in Russia behind United Russia. So we don't hear anything about it. We're bombarded with the minutiae of US politics so that we know everything about the Georgia runoff election, etc. But Russian politics is just retreated. Oh, well, Putin is just a dictator. Yeah, he's a dictator. They just won a referendum to change the constitution. They didn't win it overwhelmingly, but they won it pretty convincingly. And that, of course, is just poo-pooed in the West. Well, they must be being brainwashed then. And you feel like saying, unlike you, of course, who know all about it. And I really wonder if I was to have a conversation with Marvin Rees about Russian politics, what he actually knows. Because the truth of the matter is that there's an enormous amount of ignorance in the West about the realities in Russia.
Martin, the fact of the matter is that most, it seems to me anyway, most of these politicians nowadays don't think for themselves. They rely on other people to think for them. Well,
there is a groupthink that goes on. I mean, if you read liberal newspapers like The Guardian, even in the cultural sections and TV reviews and stuff, everybody knows that Putin is a dictator, except that he's been re-elected several times.
Well, that's right.
Because he wins the elections.
Anyway, let's let Alex in. Alex, we're going to go talk a little bit about the Uyghurs now. I wonder if you'd like to stay on for that discussion.
Yeah, sure, why not? Although, you know, I have to tell you, I know no more than what is being published in the mainstream media about this.
Okay, well, what we're going to do now is we're going to hear from a little interview I did yesterday with the Uyghur Congress people. Her name is Rahima Malmut, and I think it's one of the most important things there is around at all at the moment. And we're going to start, before we go hear from Rahima, the whole issue of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province in the west of China came up at Prime Minister's Questions. And I think it was Lib Dem leader Ed Davey that brought it up at Prime Minister's Questions.
Ed Davey, can I start by thanking the government for their change of policy announced today on the vaccination priority for people with learning disabilities, despite the Prime Minister's rather more equivocal answer to me on this last Monday. Mr. Speaker, today, millions of Uyghur people in China live in fear under a cruel regime. The BBC, international media, and human rights NGOs are all reporting on forced labour camps, women being raped and sterilised, and families being separated. This is a genocide happening in front of our eyes. So does the Prime Minister agree with me that unless China ends this genocide, Britain and Team GB should boycott the Winter Olympics in Beijing next year?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman is absolutely right to highlight the appalling campaign against the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, and that's why the Foreign Secretary, my honourable the Foreign Secretary, has set out the policies that he has, the package of measures to ensure that no British companies are complicit in or profiting from violations. We're leading international action in the UN to hold China to account, and we'll continue to work with the US, friends and partners around the world to do just that. He raises a point about a sporting boycott. We're not normally in favour of sporting boycotts in this country, Mr. Speaker, and that's been the long-standing position of this government.
Well, he's dodging that one. This has all kind of come to a head, really, because of a documentary producer called Robin Bamwell, and his documentary he did, which won the BAFTA award last year. It's called Undercover Inside China's Digital Gulag. And the woman we're about to hear from, she was one of the researchers and translators on that award-winning documentary, you know, the Inside China's Digital Gulag documentary. So let's have a listen now to Rahima Mahmoud as she talks about what she thinks is the President Xi's actual ambition. What is he really doing in Xinjiang, and why this massive surveillance state with now 3 million Uyghurs being re-educated in what she calls concentration camps?
President Xi wants to become the superpower of the world. He made himself to be the president for life. Uyghur region, it's different from the other regions. It's very similar to the Tibet situation, but again, it has its very unique geographical and also its wealth. East Turkestan, the Chinese, they say openly the resource of black and white gold. Black is the oil, petrochemical, and the natural gas. Taklamakan Desert is the second largest desert in the world, and they found a huge resource of natural gas and oil. And cotton industry, and the white gold means cotton. 84% of China's cotton come from the region. 20% of world cotton come from the region. And also because of very special geographic location and the One Belt, One Road, the China dream, which Xi Jinping believe, and that is the way that he can become the superpower in the you know, on the world stage. And the people from the these concentration camps, all of them said this is a party line. And they said in 2035, China will become the world power. Every country will have to listen to China, will have to negotiate with China. And in 2050, there will be one universe and one China. And Xi Jinping consider the region being a troubled region. And because the stability is the most important for his One Belt, One Road dream. And don't forget, the One Belt, One Road start from the East Turkestan, Kashgar, at the heart of the old Silk Road. And the Chinese Communist Party are paranoid. They're paranoid about the so-called independent movement and the terrorists or separatists. These are just an excuse in order to complete control over the region, over its resource, and over its people. Not only the people physically, also their thoughts, their language, that what they believe. That has to be the Chinese version, the CCP version. And that is what is happening.
So what do you think is the biggest hope for the Uyghur people now?
This is a heartbreaking question. I mean, I don't know if there is any immediate solution that, you know, liberate all those suffering in these concentration camps and even the people who are living in their own home and not feel safe. But the hope is, for me, is people. People in the world must wake up. The world promised never again, and it is happening again. But I could see hope from my own campaign when I compared 2 years ago and now, and the people who now understand what is happening, the numbers are increasing. And also, if you watch the parliament debates and the Uyghur issue and the Uyghur genocide is repeatedly debated in the parliament. We know U.S., the Trump administration declared this as a genocide. And only a few days ago, Canadian parliament overwhelmingly voted 266 against zero. And what is happening in China, what the CCP doing against the Uyghur people are genocide and a crime against humanity. Today, another news from Dutch parliament, a majority voted that the genocide is taking place. And in this country, we know there has not been really meaningful action, but there are voices from Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab. They're all calling this is unacceptable crimes. But in order for our government to do more, we need a grassroots campaign, more people to join the Stop Uyghur Genocide campaign. And I believe people's power. In the end, if the whole world, especially the democratic countries, unite together and against and punish China, and the CCP regime might change its attitude, and that they realize the policy against my people is wrong and not going to make them become a superpower in the world, on the world stage.
Well, I'll put a link up on our show page to the CBS, the US, or the PBS version of that documentary, because although it won the BAFTA award, you can't watch it online from last year. But that was from the Uyghur Congress, uyghurcongress.org, Rahima Mahmoud. This all sounds a little bit reminiscent of the Jews. This time it's the Muslims, Alex.
Yeah, and you know, Tony, as I told you, I don't know that this is actually going on, you know, because I think that the Western media and political establishments have something of a habit of manufacturing these humanitarian crises or exaggerating them, you know, like when they, you know, we're falling back on the logic of empire that they cannot tolerate rivals. And so, you know, China is another target for destabilization. And, you know, if we look back during our lifetimes, we remember those the story about the babies being thrown in the out of the incubators in Iraq.
Hang on. This is 3 yeah. million. Well, I mean, at least 1 million people in these re-education camps. And they've got a pretty horrific system there, where in all the main towns in Xinjiang province, every 200 meters or so, there's a checkpoint and everybody has to go through them. You know, I'll put up a link to the full interview, which is an hour or so with Rahima Mahmoud, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And in a minute, what we'll be hearing is the testimony of a woman, Tursunay Ziwadun, who has some horrendous experiences. But you're saying you think this may be just manufactured propaganda?
Well, I'm saying that I would like to have evidence of this, because, you know, like, we also know that the, you know, the famous Tiananmen Square massacre never happened. We know that this never happened. I don't know why the West is so hung up on the Uyghurs, but nobody says a word about the Rohingya, who are having horrific time in Myanmar. Why nobody raises their voice again for the Muslims in Yemen and so forth.
Well, I think Rahima would say that there isn't really much coverage of what's been going on with the Uyghurs. She doesn't feel that there is.
Well, you know, I'd like to have more than her word, because, you know, her word, her allegations, she could be the same type of a person, the same type of a role, playing the same type of a role as a Kuwait ambassador's daughter in the U.S. Congress who was talking about witnessing Iraqi soldiers throwing out babies out of incubators.
I'll tell you what, what we'll do is after we've heard from Martin, we will hear her talking about some of the abuses going on over there. Martin, what do you make of the Uyghur business? They're saying the Uyghur Congress say there's 3 million in these re-education camps, and the reason is that these people don't believe that President Xi is a kind of god figure, and they've got their own ideas. In fact, they're Muslims, and President Xi doesn't like it.
Well, she referred to Xinjiang province as East Turkestan, and the organization she works for is funded by the US government. Did she tell you that? That's what they're funded by. So they are not necessarily, and I don't necessarily disagree that something is going on there, but you've got to be a bit, you've got to understand that they are part of a global contest for power. And of course, as Alex pointed out, we're not hearing anything about the Turkish repression in Kurdistan against the PKK and their supporters. We're not hearing about what's going on in Kashmir, which has been under complete lockdown by the Indian military for several months now. We're not hearing about Yemen. That is something that we are directly involved in. It's probably the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet, and British military personnel are directly involved in the bombing campaign. Now, there's something called propaganda. We hear about certain things and we don't hear about other things. Now, at the moment, they're ramping up the possibility of confrontation with China. And that doesn't mean that things aren't bad in Xinjiang. I'm willing to keep an open mind about that. Things all over the world are quite bad. But isn't it interesting that we want to have sanctions on China for doing things in East Turkestan, as she called it, which is a provocation. But we're not going to do anything about Yemen, where we are directly involved in Saudi Arabia's invasion of Yemen. That's like invading Poland or invading Norway. And they do exactly the same thing in Bahrain.
Can I just ask you for a minute, Martin?
We're not hearing about that.
Martin, I want you to actually address Xinjiang directly.
Let's talk about Xinjiang directly.
Because if we're hearing from the Uyghur Congress, which you're right, is part funded by the National Endowment on Democracy, which is the US State Department. Yeah. If we're hearing about the stuff there, and like I said, I'll put up the link to the documentary, which has gone out on ITV and PBS, where they're going undercover, basically, with Chinese officials filming them saying that these people don't have any human rights. And we'll hear in a minute some testimony from somebody who's been abused in these camps. I think you've just got to address this one specific thing rather than saying, why aren't we talking...
All right, well, let's come to the specifics of that particular conflict. It's not entirely peaceful. There have been terrorist attacks in Xinjiang by groups which are aligned with jihadi terrorists. There are thousands of Uyghurs fighting inside the Idlib pocket in Syria. And they are linked through the MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, because their language is very similar to Turkish.
Why is China controlling that part of the world, which is actually Turkic? It's not even the Han Chinese.
Yes, indeed.
So
they've got a Turkic background.
It's a bit like Ireland, Martin. It's a bit like Ireland being run by Han Chinese in a Turkic region, a massive region of Western China, which by rights, the Chinese should just let these people run their own affairs rather than trying to ethnically cleanse them.
Well, in that case, the Israelis should withdraw immediately from all the land that's not
talking about Israel.
Otherwise, they're carrying out genocide, Tony.
We're talking about Xinjiang. Martin. We're talking about Xinjiang, not Israel.
The Uyghurs, thousands of them, are fighting as jihadi militants in Syria as we speak. They're inside the Idlib pocket.
So is that a reason to put them in concentration camps?
The Chinese army are in Syria.
Martin, is that a reason to put them in concentration camps?
No, But that's exactly what the British did during the Boer War, if you remember.
Is that justifiable?
Concentration camp.
Is that justifiable?
Exactly what we did in Malaya in the 1950s. And if they've got a military opposition to them, which they have, in Afghanistan, there are lots and lots of people who are being held in concentration camps by the Western military because they're supporters of the Taliban. Now, in actual fact, this is going on all over the world. And it's not just happening.
And it's nothing. Special about the Chinese Communist Party taking over and controlling these people as they have done. Anyway, look, Alex,
the nationalist Chinese in Taiwan still regard Xinjiang as part of China. And China's, if we're going to start breaking China up, maybe we should start breaking up the United States. There are actually rules about this.
Yeah, Kashmir, but I mean,
if they were given a vote, would vote
in the United
India.
States.
So they're not allowed to leave India.
Whereabouts?
Martin,
whereabouts in the United States are people being put in concentration camps at the scale of 2 million?
In Central America, which is run by the United States, the government of Honduras was put in a military coup.
The Chinese Communist Party can do no wrong. Martin, the Chinese Communist Party can do no wrong in your eyes.
No, I'm just pointing out that it's very interesting that we want to go on about how the Chinese are doing this, that and the other, and all of these other...
You don't want to talk about it. You don't even want to address the fact that we're looking at a potential genocide here equivalent to the Jews in Nazi Germany.
I don't accept. If you actually look at the... If you go to Moon of Alabama, there's got some very good discussions about this. It's a website run by a German investigative
Okay, well, I'll tell you what.
They were not given the under the one.
Let's have a listen to the Uyghurs themselves, shall we? Alex, one last word from you.
Uyghurs funded by the UN.
Alex,
those Uyghurs.
Alex, not Martin. Alex, can we have just a last word for you on this? As Martin and I will battle this one out, I think it's probably as well to say goodbye and give you the last word before we hear from the Uyghurs themselves about their experiences in these concentration camps.
Well, you know, I have to agree with Martin's takes because, you know, how many times in the last decades do we fall for this Western grandstanding on human rights issues where they manufacture a crisis or exaggerated greatly to target a nation for destabilization. And of course, you know, like you will always find people who will tell you horrible things. But you know, do you remember the time when Kim Jong-un was killing his girlfriends once he was done with them, and then they turned up alive when he had his uncle assassinated by anti-aircraft. Anti-aircraft guns, and then he turned up alive. Complete fabrications, like the Tiananmen Square massacre. So the West very often creates these massive fabrications. I want to see evidence. If this is happening, I want to see evidence. And if there's evidence, then we should treat the plight of the Uyghurs at the same level as the plight of the Yemenis, of the Palestinians, of the Kashmiris and so forth. You know, singling out one that happened to be in the target for destabilization country, China, for me is suspect, and testimony from local people isn't evidence, you know, especially if they're funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. So I remain very skeptical about this.
Right. So anyway, thanks very much, Alex Craner, for joining us. Fascinating insight. And we'll speak to you again sometime. But we're going to hear.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And maybe you'd like to plug your book finally. So if people are interested, particularly the Grand Deception one, which is absolutely I think it's a crucial read if anyone wants to understand the new Cold War.
Yeah. So the book title is Grand Deception: The Truth About Bill Browder, the Magnitsky Act, and Anti-Russian Sanction. It has been banned by Amazon twice, so it's not available on Amazon, but it is available on the website of the only publisher brave enough to publish it, which is called Red Pill Press. So their website is redpillpress.com.
Okay, Alex Craner, thanks very much. And now we're
going to
from Mahima Mahmoud again, this time her testimony about a woman called Tursunay Zuwaydun, and this is from the Uyghur Congress, Rahima Mahmoud.
she was released because her husband campaigned for her release. Her husband is Kazakh nationality, Kazakhstan, who hold Kazakh passport.
Okay, Kazakhstan, so what's her name?
Tursunay Ziyabedin.
And what's her testimony?
Her testimony. So she returned to visit her family with her husband in 2017 because she has been living in Kazakhstan for 5 years. And they returned once. They didn't have any problems. So the second time, they didn't think that they will encounter any problem because she was working in her husband's clinic. Her husband is a doctor, as a nurse. And after she returned in 2017, and suddenly one day when she was all walking in the street, police came in and arrested her. And she spent 2 months in this re-education school. At the time, she said things were not as bad. They were deprived from sleeping, food, but she didn't experience torture. But she felt very, very ill because of the food. She had a developed stomach ulcer, and she was released after 2 months. And then in 2018, and she was arrested again, because when her husband left the country, the government said that you must return after 2 months back to the country. But husband didn't return. And then they said, because you also signed the agreement that you promised your husband would return within 2 months, but he didn't. Therefore, we have to detain you until your husband returned to the country. And so she said the horror, so said horror started from the time I entered the gate. And we must pass through a checkpoint. They pulled out our earrings without care. And they herded us into a room in a hurry as there were so many people. The scene is still clearly in front of my eyes. And said from 8th of March, a mass arrest started in Kunas, which lasted 3 to 4 days. And when she arrived there on that day, she said there were 4 buses parked in a line. Police were ushering people nonstop. And well, if you would like me to tell more about what happened after she entered the cell, and she said, I was with 4 or 5 other women. One of them was an elderly lady. I forgot to think about my own fear and the suffering, but I was watching her, how she was treated so roughly, and she was stripped to almost naked because they shouted at her, why did you wear long dress and wear headscarf? But culturally, traditionally, all our women, they wear long dress and wear headscarf. And so she said it was absolutely horrific after arriving in the cell. So at night, after midnight, every evening, 3 to 4 men who wore masks and wore glasses, and they didn't wear police uniform, and they would come and pick the woman. And she said she didn't know at the time this rape was happening. She thought they were taken away for questioning. And she said in the cell, there are three, four CCTV cameras that monitor every movement. Despite living with 12, 13 women in this cell, they are not allowed to speak to one another. And she said even after she was tortured, after she was raped, she came back to the cell and said, just like any other woman, we would just lie quietly in the bed and just cry. We cannot share what happened to us because we know if we did tell someone in the cell, immediately we will be taken back and then be tortured or raped. And she mentioned about the pills, the injections, every week and every other week they had these injections. And she said after had this injection, she developed a terrible skin problem. And she said it felt like insects were walking between the flesh and bone and couldn't bear it. And many women suffered heavy bleeding and many women afterwards stopped their periods. And she said also after taking these pills and after forced injections, you completely become numb. And for days, you cannot remember even your own family members. And all you think is that when they can give me food, because you suffer from this hunger so terribly, and you only think about I wish no one would come and take me out for questioning or torture. I just wish they can give me more food. And that is not just the one survivor, Gulzira Ziauddin. And Qalbinur Siddiq, one of the camp teachers who left the region in 2019 after taught in two different camps, one male and one female. And she also revealed that everyone was chained and shackled when they came to the classes. And they were separated. There is a metal bar and glasses separated the teachers and the students. And she said everyone, all the females, their head was shaven. And most of these detainees, she learned that they were detained there because they studied abroad and they visited abroad, had family members abroad, or had foreign apps like WhatsApp installed in their phones. And these were the crimes that they were taken to that women's camp.
Yeah, so I suppose none of this actually happened, Martin.
Well, the first thing to point out is that it's not the person concerned. It's somebody reporting it at second hand.
So you don't think it happened?
I don't know whether it happened or not. I'm just pointing out a fact. That person wasn't in those camps. She says she spoke to somebody who was. Yeah. And as Alex pointed out earlier, the Western media, and as we were pointing out earlier in the show, they're not necessarily entirely to be trusted. And, of course, that may or may not have taken place.
So are you justifying what the Chinese government are doing in Xinjiang?
What the Chinese government... You see, what you could have done is approach the Chinese embassy to get their comment on this. What they would say, and I have read the sort of things they're saying, we are facing an armed insurgency inside the province. And there's actually been bomb attacks and assassinations. It's pretty similar, as you said earlier, to Ireland or Kurdistan or Kashmir. And the same kind of things are done in Ireland. Lots of people were detained without trial. In Kurdistan, inside Turkey now, lots of people have been killed, tens of thousands.
Okay, so you're saying that the internment is okay?
Internment is a strategy for a counter-guerrilla warfare.
What about a million?
If you're facing an armed opposition, don't forget
million people,
the Uyghurs...
People?
have got thousands people, Martin, of young men
fighting to inside
Syria, having been trained by the Turkish army.
Is it okay to inter 2 million
Chinese army have got their people as observers with the Syrian Arab army, because what they fear
is talking about Syria, Martin. We're not talking about Syria. We're talking about China.
Yes, and in China itself, Tony, there have been Uyghur terrorist attacks inside Beijing. There have been Uyghur terrorist attacks. There is an armed opposition.
Do you think they may that may be
inside China?
Do you think that may
they may be 2 million
of them have been interred? But do you think that may be because 2 million Uyghurs have been interred?
Well, what's actually happened in Vietnam and various other places in Afghanistan when it was run by the Russians or now by the Americans is that these techniques don't actually work a lot of the time. It just gets the populations back up and they get more militant. So there is obviously two sides to the story. But the idea that it's that they shouldn't do this, they're going to do it. The Chinese are quite open about, yes, we have got camps for people because we're worried that they're being radicalized by Saudis and by Turks. And that we're and the Turkish military, and that we're going to have to fight them if we
and they're going to re-educate them. Are they going to it's nothing to do with the fact that they just want them to, first of all, speak Han Chinese rather than their own language. I mean, it's a form of genocide going on here, surely.
No, well, genocide's a big word, Tony, isn't it? It's a political repression.
Well, that's the word they use, yeah.
Yeah, well, yes, and the Kurds would say that the Turks are carrying out genocide against them. But that, the Western media don't go on about genocide against the Turks, against the Kurds, do they? Because the Turkey's part of NATO. And, of course, we don't criticise Modi for what he's doing in Kashmir, which is probably
I think it's a rather shoddy technique of just talking about other conflicts in other parts of the world, where actually we're trying to focus here on Xinjiang, on the Uyghurs,
yes, two million
of which are in these. Well, I mean, they say 3 million. Official figures are more like a million. So let's go in between and say 2 million of the people going into these re-education camps. I mean, they're never going to be able to succeed at this, surely.
Well, there's clearly a political conflict here. But ultimately, of course, if you've got a state, then the state is going to behave like a state, whether it's the Indian state in Kashmir or the Chinese state in Xinjiang
or
the Turkish state
China.
In what they call, they don't call it Kurdistan, they say it's Turkey. The Kurds say it's
Kurdistan. It's not Kurdistan we're talking about China.
These conflicts,
China is
there are concentrations.
Martin, China is a dictatorship.
People being put in re-education.
Martin, China is a dictatorship where you're not allowed to disagree with the president.
Down. China is a dictatorship, so they can't do it. Turkey's
No. I'm not saying that's why they can't do it. They can't do it because it's immoral, number one, and also it's counterproductive and it's mass murder. But President Xi is not allowing anybody to disagree with him. That's basically what we're living in China.
There was a study carried out by Yale University, I think it was, in China. They carry them out all the time. They're basically testing public opinion inside China. And in actual fact, there's lots of linkages between universities in China and in the West, particularly in the STEM subjects. But this was social sciences, and they concluded that 90% of the people of China support the government. Now, some people in the Uyghur regions don't. But don't forget, there's nearly a billion people in China. So even
isn't China just an experiment in mass brainwashing?
China is a very complex society in a very big place. And of course, it's not an entirely free country. But then we're not an entirely free country where our secret services can invade various countries and kill millions.
Yeah, well, you can't compare the lack of freedom of speech that there is in China to the relative freedom of speech, even if you don't have the right to be heard.
Yeah, but if you're part of the Western core, then you get relative freedom of speech. But of course, if you happen to live in one
You get freedom of speech in Britain, even if you're having a go at the royal family, which we do quite a bit on here. We did a big piece on that last week.
But of course,
if you were to do that show in China,
they're not using concentration camps.
Martin, if you were to do last week's show in China, we would all be under arrest.
Well, I can see where you're going with this, Tony. Now, are we going for a regime change in China? Is that the policy? I mean,
you think that's what I'm saying? Martin, we're trying to do some balanced journalism, and you, well, it doesn't seem to me, it doesn't seem to me, we've heard your views, and that's
no, called, I'm that's not the Chinese called, government, I've got my own view.
Called balanced journalism.
The idea is to actually let some
Uyghur people speak, rather than just to say, well, it doesn't matter that 2 million of them are in these concentration camps because they're Chinese government is being attacked by the West in various ways.
I'm just putting some context in it, Tony.
Anyway, so maybe there is some spinning being done on various sides, but at least I think we can make our own minds up if we have a listen to what all sides are saying. And particularly understand that the Chinese government is not anything like our government. For example, there are 35 million less women than men in China, and that is because of the one-child policy, which, by the way, Henry Kissinger was involved in bringing in the 1970s and was introduced in 1980. And that is roughly the female population of Britain have been exterminated in China before they've even been born.
Well, in actual fact, I was going to talk about the one-child policy before you interrupted me, because the Uyghur, like many other minorities, have never been victims of the one-child policy. They've been allowed to have as big families as they like. The one-child policy only applies to Han Chinese, because they realised that it would be very difficult for the Uyghur population to accept such policy, and they were basically allowed not to be dealt with by it.
Oh, well, that's because they're outside the mind control system, isn't it?
Well,
the
Chinese government's official policy is that they recognise minority rights, but they don't recognise the right of armed rebellion against the government. That's the bottom line.
If you're going to put people in concentration camps, of course they're going to rebel. And I don't know where they get their weapons from. Maybe they get them from the West, and maybe this is all orchestrated. But it doesn't mean to say that it's right to use ISIS concentration camps to lock Muslims up like they did the Jews in Nazi Germany.
Well, isn't it funny that we're all so worried about what's interesting, in fact, that Erdogan has not criticised the Chinese about what's going on with the Uyghur, because in actual
he's
fact,
a gangster.
He's the
That's
Chinese
right. He's
to
a gangster.
The Americans.
Because he's
and
a
of
gangster.
Course, there was a military coup attempted in Turkey against the
Martin,
Democratic
we're not talking about Turkey.
Supported
we're talking about
by
China.
The Americans.
Anyway,
which hundreds of people
we're going to wind the programme up now. I know you want to talk about everything on earth apart from Xinjiang.
You've got to put it in context, Tony.
We've got a military
occupation of Afghanistan. We invaded Afghanistan, and the British Army got its backside kicked in Helmand Province by the locals, who are very similar to the kind of people you're going to find
Maybe that's why the Chinese have decided to put them all in concentration camps. Anyway,
that's why the British Army went home, because they weren't going to win.
We're going to hear now from this documentary. We heard a clip with Kevin last week. It's called Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers. And the reason I'm banging on about this is because I was so frustrated and annoyed to see it being censored. I downloaded it from BitChute last week, and then literally I was going to put a link up to it, and I realised, good God, it's disappeared already. Yeah, so the documentary is called Israel and the Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers, and we'll wind up with this tonight and let Martin comment after we've heard this clip, which really talks about Bobby Kennedy, and it's the closing part of the documentary by Laurent Guillenot.
President Kennedy's son, John Kennedy Jr., embodied the Kennedy myth in the heart of all Americans. The route seemed traced for him to become president one day. He died on July 16, 1999, with his pregnant wife and his sister-in-law, when his private plane suddenly and mysteriously nosedived into the ocean a few seconds after he had announced his approach on Martha's Vineyard Airport. John Jr. was literally born with the Kennedy presidency. From the minute he came into this world, he had been in the national spotlight. As Americans watched him grow up in the White House, they developed a strong affection for him. The iconic image of little John John saluting his father's coffin on the day of his third birthday encapsulated a nation's grief and impressed on millions of Americans the dream of seeing him reclaim the Oval Office one day. For in the American collective psyche, the Kennedys represented royalty and JFK Jr. was the legitimate heir to the throne. In 1995, John launched his political magazine, George. Under the appearance of superficiality, it engaged in controversial issues of deep politics that reflected John's interest for conspiracy issues. For example, in December 1996, George was the only mainstream magazine exploring the inconsistencies of the official report on the explosion of Flight TWA-800 soon after leaving JFK International on July 17, 1996. The National Transportation Safety Board claimed it was an accident, although 375 witnesses saw one or two bright flare objects hit the plane, many of them believing it was a missile. Israeli intelligence had actually tried to put the blame on an Iranian missile, but some investigators believed this was in fact a failed Israeli false flag attack designed to force the United States into retaliating against Iran. In March 1997, George published an article by the mother of Yigal Amir, the man convicted of assassinating Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, claiming that her son had been manipulated by Israeli deep state operatives. In October 1998, John Kennedy Jr. released a special conspiracy issue of George magazine, which included an article by film director Oliver Stone. According to testimonies from his friends, John Jr. was haunted by the death of his father and quite knowledgeable about independent investigations about it. At age 39, John was preparing his entry into politics and he was about to announce it publicly. He had also expressed to his friend his ambition to ultimately reach for the presidency. While trying to shield him from celebrity, his mother Jackie had raised him in the worship of his father and in the idea of his own presidential destiny. According to his biographers, in 1999, John had made up his mind to launch his political career. Given his personality and his immense popularity, he had high chances to make it to the presidency in less than 20 years. John Jr. would have started his political career in New York, the city he loved and that loved him. According to some of his friends, he would have aimed at the seat of governor in 2003. According to others, he had decided to run for the New York Senate seat in 2000. This is the seat that his uncle Bobby had occupied from 1964 to 1968 and that Daniel Moynihan, a former assistant to President Kennedy, was going to leave vacant in 2000. John's chances were great. According to his biographer, Christopher Anderson, John's plan interfered with Hillary Clinton's. The Clintons, who were to leave the White House in January 2001, had just purchased a home in New York State, and Hillary was gearing up to run for the Senate as a stepping stone to her own presidential future. Hillary had never resided in New York State before, and her chances to beat John Jr. were very weak. John's death allowed her to win the seat. Has the American Zionist criminal deep state perceived the danger that John Jr. represented from the moment he started his political career? Many elements suggest that his death had not been an accident. Several witnesses testified having heard or seen his plane explode. Its sudden and steep fall cannot be explained as a pilot's error, as claimed by the official report. On the order of President Clinton, the rescue and recovery missions were conducted under national security conditions by the Navy, and the investigation was supervised by the same people in the National Transportation Safety Board who had falsified the investigation on TWA-800. Once the bodies were recovered, no autopsy was conducted. They were cremated and their ashes scattered at sea in a Navy ceremony, although this was not in the tradition of either families. John would certainly have wished to be buried besides his father and mother.
So that's Laurent Guillenot there with the sort of closing parts of his documentary, Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers. Much of the, I mean, we got into maybe a bit more detail about the Israel connections last week, Martin, which were really the way that this served the Israeli mafia effectively in the US, and also the obvious connections between these various assassinations of this family. It's interesting to note that Robert Kennedy Jr. is now one of the leading campaigners in the United States against the same oligarchy, against Bill Gates. And his vaccine programs, particularly those in the third world, where he's been basically experimenting on poor people in Africa. But anyway, what do you make of this idea that maybe the Israeli mafia, the Israeli government even had a hand in getting rid of the Kennedys?
Well, I'd certainly, you know, we carry on investigating. There clearly is political assassination is the norm in the United States of America. Senator Paul Wellstone was probably assassinated as well. There was even been a court case in Mississippi in front of a jury. It was a civil court, but they concluded that the government were responsible for the assassination of Martin Luther King. So you've got this huge cognitive dissonance in US society between they have a national holiday for Martin Luther King and nobody's allowed to say a word against the guy and he's supposedly a great hero of the country. Nevertheless, you've had a jury conclude that the government actually assassinated him, and both things are true. Of course, most people are unaware that a jury has already come to that conclusion, just as they're unaware that the courts in Kiev concluded that it was NATO intelligence operation which killed all the people in the Maidan Square.
Yeah, or with the Diana assassination.
Well, okay, so the point is...
Martin, with the Diana assassination, that the actual verdict was unlawful killing, which suggests an assassination rather than it is being an accident. And so we still keep talking, at least the media do, about the Diana accident, where actually the court itself has shown that she was killed unlawfully.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because that brings to my mind what happened with Berezovsky in Surrey. Because the British coroner concluded that Berezovsky did not necessarily commit suicide, although the British state was determined that that should be the verdict. Now, of course, you'd have thought Berezovsky being a major opponent of Putin, or historically so, they would big that up immediately and said, isn't this terrible? This guy didn't commit suicide. He must have been murdered and it must have been Putin. But of course, it wasn't Putin that murdered him. It was MI6 who probably murdered him, as Berezovsky's family are quite clear to say. Okay, but you don't see that on the top of News at 10, do you? Berezovsky's family think he was murdered by MI6.
If we dare to go back to the situation with China, wasn't it interesting that after the Kennedy assassination and Nixon's presidency with Kissinger as his Secretary of State, that was when the supposed rapprochement, started with the Chinese. At least there was a visit with Nixon and a guy called William F. Buckley, who, by the way, also, along with the Bushes and many others, is one of these members of the Yale University Skull and Bones. I just think it seems obvious to me now, after many years of looking at this, that there is cooperation at the top levels between the West and China at the elite levels. Look at the fact that the American satellites are being used as part of the Xinjiang surveillance system. That was a story that broke last year. And we can see that actually the Americans are cooperating with the Chinese when it comes to repressing their own people. So don't you think actually there is some sort of cooperation at the top levels between these? Because look at what's going on, particularly in Xinjiang, but elsewhere in China, increasingly in Hong Kong. These authoritarian surveillance systems are now being looked at by authoritarian types in the West. And they're going, well, this is great. We'd love to have this here where everyone is under surveillance. In fact, here in the UK, over many years, we had something called CAPRIM, C-A-P-R-I-M, and another organisation which was keeping a whole database of left-wing activists, union activists, etc., and then making sure they could never get jobs. Now, it's not a great leap of the imagination to suggest that such a database, which they said they were going to get rid of, but of course they never did, could be used for a similar sort of situation that they've got in China with their social credit system over here, denying people like you and I jobs in the professions where we might flourish, and making sure that people who are left-wing activists of various sorts, union activists, even particular faiths may have no success in society and be deprived of any kind of income.
Well, if you say that repressive systems tend to be similar, then that's pretty much obvious, isn't it? The question is, are they in alliance? And the answer is not really. I mean, there is obviously interactions between elite players in Russia, China and the West. I mean, it's what you'd expect. I mean, don't forget, until quite recently, there were no foreigners in China at all. And the relationship with the West was absolutely hostile, you know, in a very extreme way. And after 1972, the US leadership decided that because they knew that there was big hostility between the Chinese and the Soviets, and they decided to play the game of we're going to be friendly with the Chinese in order to destroy the Soviet Union. And at the same time, the Mujahideen who fought against the Red Army in Afghanistan were being armed, trained and supported both by Pakistan and by the West, but also by the Chinese, because they didn't like the Russians being in Afghanistan. So there was an alignment of interest between the Maoist state at that stage and the Western, and of course the same thing happened. China invaded Vietnam at that stage.
What do you make of what I was saying earlier about Mao in 1919 and 1920 running the magazine for Yale University's China Project?
Well, it doesn't surprise me at all. In actual fact, lots of communist leadership in the Third World was educated in Western universities. That was the only place to get an education. Ho Chi Minh studied in Paris. But that doesn't mean Ho Chi Minh was pro-French. Viet Minh drove the French out of Vietnam. Vietnam and China today are actually on opposite sides. The Vietnamese are much closer to the West and the Chinese are not. Nevertheless, the real world is actually messier than the good
well,
guys.
Well, I don't think there's anything. There's nothing messy about Yale University paying Chairman Mao in 1919 and 1920 to get his foothold going.
Mao was a fairly minor
as the editor of their newspaper, and then paying for him to start bookshops in various other parts of China. There's nothing messy about that. That's actually quite forensically done.
Yes, and of course, the thing that brought Mao to the attention of the world was the book Red Star Over China, which was written by an American journalist whose name escapes me offhand, but it basically made Mao's career. He became the leader of the Western of the Chinese Communist Party in the minds of the West and in the minds of the Chinese. And at that stage, the US was actually trying to get influence in China, both through the nationalists, through Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang, and also opened up discussions with the communists. Because don't forget, the nationalists and the communists had been in an alliance together against the Japanese, who the Americans were fighting. So that, you know, all of these histories. And don't forget, Stalin was our ally in the Second World War. It really wasn't just the Battle of Britain that defeated the Nazis. I think Stalin
I don't think any of our listeners think it was. But anyway, if people want to hear a non-Martin Summers communist view of what's going on in Xinjiang, and they want to hear from a Uyghur. And also, one of the things I will do is I'll put some music at the end of the show on the podcast you can download, which is some Uyghur music, which they sent me, which is, I think most of it seems to be recorded here in the West, because it's so difficult for them to basically just carry on and do their normal stuff in their homeland. And so the interview with Rahima Mahmoud from the part funded by the U.S. Endowment on Democracy, UyghurCongress.org, I'll put a full version of that on her show page if you want to hear. And she talks, for example, a great deal about, you know, how we got where we are. What's the history of the Uyghurs over there? And when did the Chinese first take over that part of the world? So time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Alex Craner, as a market analyst based in Monaco, author of The Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Act and Anti-Russian Sanctions. Also, you just heard there Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Since Yahoo and Google have manoeuvred me onto their email lists and then banned those lists, either for posts I couldn't moderate or fake anti-Semitism claims, the only way to be included on my weekly email circulation list is to email me now at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find that address on the contact tab on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. If you've got a site or story you'd like to share, think there's anything we've missed, or have a correction, please do reply to that weekly email with a link or two, or even a scan of what you have, if possible. Download our MP3s, and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show podcast, story links, and comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. tonight on Fridays, and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch in two places, from noon at richieallen.co.uk and also on camberleysradioq.com. Do please make recordings of the stream. Unless our MP3 platform's down, which it sometimes is at the weekends, feel free to download and rebroadcast this show anywhere you like, and we'll list you here. But do credit us at thisweek.org.uk and request this show's reinstatement on FM. If you like, links to email the head of BCFM, Honchos, are on the contact tab at our show page, thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Can't you see? Amen.